Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. Right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGG QA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this horribly named podcast series. Sorry, I ran out of air in a weird place. Of course, the important part is QA. It's a question and answer as we start off our tech week. It's why I like to hold my show on a Monday. Get to hang out with an amazing crew. I already see some great faces here in the live chat. We can spend some time sort of going through all the tech stories of the last week. Maybe news broke over the weekend. Maybe we survived a hurricane. So... We kind of like to sort of set these artificial benchmarks throughout the week and throughout the month, but, you know, Monday does always seem to hit with a different kind of energy to it. So I'm seeing Cedric, Al Sabakli, Barry, Lampros, Marilyn saying good morning to everybody. Good morning, Marilyn. Nick Gay, where do we got? Barry, Cedric, Lampros. I'm missing some people in here. Oh, Vince Navoa, Go Starscream, Coppa Cash, Simon Says Hypno. I'm sorry, J-Man150 saying, hey, and Scoop, hey, hey, everybody say good morning to Bionic Scoop. Okay, folks, Simon Says Hypno, I demand a hello. Hey, what's up? Snorkel Bill, happy Monday. I feel pretty good on Mondays. This is the sort of ritual where Juan also uses his audience as a bit of a sort of a therapy session to get through all of the news that's been happening. This is going to be kind of a weird block of stories this week, because we've got obviously some big news just with crazy weather. Californians love talking about crazy weather anyway, but like this whole weekend was an excellent exercise in trying to prep for unknowns. Other people around the country were like, hey, you know, we've seen tornadoes and hurricanes and tropical storms. What's the big deal? Well, in Florida, if you build a house, it has to be rated for a certain category of storm. We don't do that in California. We rate for category of earthquake. So even just trying to call up, like, we called our insurance company, like, hey, do we have flood insurance? And someone, like, while looking at our account, had to go, hold on, let me dig a little deeper and check in this. Like, it wasn't just a thing that you had accessible to you. The entire weekend was a weekend of unknown. So hopefully, for everybody that's watching this, or if you're listening on the replay, I hope everybody who might have been affected by the storm as it went up through Baja, and it like kind of landed directly on Los Angeles. There are a whole bunch of prediction models, or it could go as far west as this or as far east as that. And thankfully, we didn't get hit directly with the eye of the storm, but we actually got a bit more rain than some of the models were predicting. So kind of rolled through our area and then just started veering east. So there was one day. I think we got more rainfall in one day than we did in all of 2020. Someone fact check me on that. I probably have my numbers wrong. But leading up to it, the big concern was we just didn't know what to expect. We live in a rather older suburb. You drive around. If you've seen like some of my e-bike videos, I'm driving around on roads that are not maintained very aggressively. We're talking old, like, hillside country where there are hiking trails and horseback riding, and it's sort of an older community, and like a lot of older people live around us. And those kinds of communities are kind of known for things like rough roads and gravel, and you can turn down someone's street, and then like at the end of the street, it just turns into dirt. Those kinds of communities typically don't have the most robust infrastructure for things like electricity, telephone wires, the cables that run broadband to your home. So we really just didn't know, like, if we get really high winds, it's going to take a tree branch hitting a wire near our transformer, and it could knock out power for this entire block. So Marie and I maybe overreacted a little bit, but I feel I'm in good company here with folks that it's probably better to overreact a little than underreact and wish you had done more to prep for an unknown. But we had the batteries charged. I actually did use it as an excuse to reshare one of my collaboration videos with Anker. We've gotten a lot of mileage out of their big crate batteries, their home generator battery things, the 757 and the 767. And so we had a lot of family asking us questions. Marie's aunt was like, okay, so I've got this CPAP and I want to do this and I want to do that. And what kind of battery do I need? And we're like, those are very good questions. I can give you some information, but unless you can tell me like how much electricity you need to use at any given time, recommending a battery can be a little tricky. But we had those battery crates charged. I also charged a bunch of my little power bricks. Here's the funky thing. So a little while ago, we did this thing where we were very critical of Samsung phones. And we were critical of older Samsung batteries, because old Samsung batteries are kind of garbage. I actually have another two old classic Samsung phones. That brings me up to a total of four that have battery puffed, and another three? Yeah, because all my actives are dead now, and another three that are just battery dead. So if you're not regularly using batteries, that's actually not a good state for them to be in. And often the battery cells will just sort of trickle drain over a period of time. And once they reach sort of a critical threshold, that can damage the battery cells. So even though I go through a lot of our power banks, I mean, like, hey, we're just going to go out to the zoo. Okay, let me grab a power bank. I've gotten into the bad habit of only grabbing like one or two of my favorite power banks, and I haven't been doing a great job of going through and kind of topping off. You know, you don't need to charge them all the way to full. So now I've got three power banks that are just dead. And you're like, man, this is a ton of e-waste. This is so much garbage we have to take to a specific recycling center. These are not, like, you do not want to be throwing lithium-ion batteries away in the garbage. So this was kind of another one of those, you know, you've got company coming over, so you spend some time to actually clean your house. We've got a hurricane coming in. Let's double check all the batteries. But on top of that, we're in the middle of the heaviest part of the downpour, and Marie gets this shocked look on her face. I think we were watching The Princess Bride. Lex and I turned it into movie day. We watched three movies, and it was really great. But Marie gets this shocked look on her face in the middle of Princess Bride, and she starts yelling, "Lex, come here. Lex, come here." And I don't know what she's upset about. At first, my wife is horrifically arachnophobic, so at first I thought, does she see a spider crawling towards Lex? What could be the problem? So Lex is like, what? So we've got to work on our family. When we say, like, come here now, that means, like, come here now. It doesn't mean, ask what's going on. It's kind of the same thing, like, in an action film. You know, like, get down! And then there's, like, someone turns around, like, why should I get down? Is something about to happen? Explain to me. I don't want to do... You need to use words to tell me what... Oh, I got shot! You know, like... She calls Lex over, And then the whole house just starts swaying. And it is not a sharp shock, because I've been in some earthquakes where it's just like a pow, it feels like a truck has hit your house. And I've been in some where it kind of like jolts you up and down. This one, it was almost a seasick kind of motion, and it's just kind of rolling. And it's just kind of rolling, and it goes on for an uncomfortably long time. And we're sitting on the couch, we've got sort of these like higher ceilings by this area of our living room. I'm thinking what we should do is just like, if it gets any stronger, we should roll off the couch and just take the couch cushions and make like a little pillow fort on top of us. Cause like this one felt, the duration was longer than I was expecting. And so it finally like kind of calms back down and she looks down at her phone and she's like, yeah, we just had a 6.0 earthquake. Like on top of a tropical storm. So, yeah, Hurricane was a very concerning period of about, I mean, roughly 48 hours from when we really started prepping and from when the rains kind of calmed back down. It was a very tense 2 days. And also, man, don't do the thing that we did where we kind of waited till the day before we just did a little bit of our normal grocery store shopping and we decided to stock up on basic stuff. You know, it wasn't like we're going to go prep for an emergency catastrophe. We didn't expect that even if we lost power that we would be out of commission for too long. But I'm going to like Vaughn's and I'm going to Trader Joe's and I'm going like just picking up like beans and rice. We eat beans and rice. I love beans and rice. I make a really spicy sort of Mexican style rice and, you know, pot of pinto beans. I can eat off that for a week. I mean, that's a meal for me. I love it. But you know, buying some extra and I'm walking around the aisles and people just like double and triple shopping carting water and toilet paper. Like at the beginning days of the pandemic, the panic buying was like, oh no, my toilet paper. And you're just like, I really feel we need like a class for adulting. We did this through a hospital one time where they're like, hey, because of some medical concerns, you might want to do this. It's an earthquake preparedness class. And, you know, I think Marie and I need to go through and sort of rebuild our earthquake kits. At one point, we had this really great, like, little backpack, and you could do this. You could grab the NAS, just make sure all our important files and photos were safe. All of that was great. Now I think we need to sort of revise it so that if something really, really bad happens, we've got what we need for all three of us better collected. But I really felt it was an interesting look at our neighbors. We're, you know, tropical storms coming in, better stock up. And you're not wrong, but also you're like, what are you picking and why is that the important, why is that the important thing to stock up on? Dave Burns, everyone, please, at this point, just invest in a bidet. Well, the last, like, add-on bidet, someone hit me up just 2 weeks ago, and like, hey, do you want to review this, and we'll send you one for free, and you're like, I don't think I can pull this off, guys, I don't think this is a video for my channel, but also part of the problem was like, oh, you need to make sure you have an outlet right next to your toilet, and you're like, old California homes, man, we did not run a lot of electricity in our bathrooms, so I don't think I can pull that off, and also, in a tropical storm, if we lose power, then there goes our bidet. Snorkel, all that toilet paper turns into pulpy goo when the floodwaters come into La Casa. Yeah, Californians, we are not great at water falling from the sky. It is not something that we handle well. We don't drive through it well. I mean, we're very passive aggressive drivers under the best of circumstances. But yeah, let me tell you guys, the hurricane of 2023, I want to make it sound like this is some like completely extraordinary weather event, but unfortunately, after the last winter that we had, I feel like this is probably going to be a more regular aspect of the wild climate instability, because throughout the state, we had tropical storms, we had earthquakes, we had wildfires all up and down the state. It's getting really rough out there. It's getting really, really crazy. Oh no, Ron Guido, with all the crazy things going on, I hesitate to mention I had a fire at my job. Not fun. Dave Burns, sorry, really sucks that we have so little faith in one another that the immediate reaction is to F you, I got mine in case of emergencies. Oh man. Nick Gay, why do people get toilet paper? Seriously, how many poops do they take? But again, it's this like this notion of a creature comfort. And I need to stock up on it, because what if something bad happens and the chain is disrupted and I'm not able to get to a store or something like that? And I gotta tell you, being a tech reviewer was really helpful. Hold on, I'm gonna take a drink of coffee here. I don't want to slurp right on top of the mic. So being a tech reviewer comes with an incredible privilege where I've been getting to try this stuff out and I've been getting to test drive some of these things, and a lot of them have stuck. Like power banks, it is such a handy adaptation. You've got little bricks of portable power. You can keep a number of different devices going. We've got some small like medical gadgets. They can all be charged off of these little mini bricks. I've got some medium-sized portable power stations with like AC plugs that can handle a certain load. And then I've got the big crate batteries. I even pulled our solar panel out of our storage unit just in case we had a couple days of downtime for power. So power's set. On top of that, I also have a lot of production equipment. So you think, you're like, oh, okay, so let's say the power goes out. Well, right now, I've got just a pair of inexpensive LED panels kind of just using as a fill light for my podcast here. It's not amazing lighting, but they can also be driven off a battery. So at the same time, I took all of my little portable bricks and I started charging these guys up too. So in the event of an emergency, we're getting to, nighttime, we don't have power, I can pull one of these batteries, pull one of these lamps, and I can go downstairs and illuminate a good chunk of our living room for a serious period of time. Bray Gray, I did the same thing with my LED lights and batteries. It kind of made me wish I'd sprung for the V-mount battery. Next purchase. It's little things. Like, I know the main reason why I got these things was because I was doing some off and on location shoots and I just needed some simple fill lights. Usually you go to a set, they've got a lighting kit or some kind of package that you can rent, something like that. But I always need these, like, I just need a soft fill. And I want something that's really easy to move around. And so I got these and they can use batteries and that's awesome. Well, now in the event of an emergency, we don't have to like kill a lamp with D cell batteries. You know, it's like all of those little pieces kind of fall into place and you get to really kind of test how far can we take this. Like, more power to Ben's gadgets. He was taking his folding phones out into a tropical storm. My Pixel Fold, hashtag gift from Google, my Pixel Fold stayed in my office. I wasn't taking my foldable out into tropical storm weather. So it just stayed. So it was an interesting time. A lot of psychology at play, a lot of anxiety. Marie and I stocked up, stashed, prepped. We did the best job that we could, that we felt we could do. And from this one, I think we've learned a little like what else we need to focus on and where a few of the holes in our strategy are. But overall, I'm glad we did okay. And hopefully no one you know was affected too badly or was hurt or, heaven forbid, you know, worse than that. So I think it's another thing that we're going to have to add to our list here in California. We got to prep not just for the fires and the earthquakes, but we are increasingly looking at inconsistent and less predictable weather patterns that we have never experienced in the last, we've been out here for 20 years. So it's pretty brutal. Simon says, no, Ben was in a brilliantly ranty mood. More power to him. that's not how I couldn't. I was looking at the rainfall thinking, like, I should make a video. I really just need to sit on the couch with my daughter and my wife. We just had an earthquake, and we're in the middle of a tropical storm. I need to not be making content right now. let's see. From McCorkran, it's never good for me because I don't get good data signals. Without Wi-Fi, my phone in my house does not get great reception, so I'm really unplugged. We did consider some of that, too. So it was little things like we use a little tablet for Lex on road trips, and it still had a whole bunch of stuff stored on it. So I made sure, while we had Wi-Fi, we never really lost power. We had a little flickery moments, but it never went down. But we went through her tablet and reactivated all of her downloads on Netflix and Disney Plus. So she had content ready to go. I run a ridiculously large NAS for a media server, for a Plex server. Now, if that goes down, if our power goes down, we don't have Wi-Fi to run Plex off of or stream locally, but I can plug the NAS into a power source for a short period of time, pull content off of the NAS, and then transfer that to one of our laptops. You know, so we had even kind of considered some of that. I downloaded some of my playlists on Qobuz. We were really trying to say, because like we get okay 5G connectivity here, but it's not really something that you can rely on for heavy duty streaming. So again, same thing, you know, our multimedia strategy was also influenced. It sounds silly, but having just a little bit of entertainment that you can kind of turn to that doesn't require streaming, the silliest of all is like still having a shelf right up there full of like old Blu-rays and stuff. And like, oh no, power's out, but I can hook up a little portable monitor to our PlayStation 4 and I guess we can watch some of Batman the Animated Series and Batman Beyond. You know, like that's such an irresponsible use of electricity, but like it also kind of works. But we had it as like a reserve. Like, let's say we're out of power for 2 days and I can run the solar panel, keep a fan going, and we want to entertain Lex and myself, and we could do that for a couple hours. So yeah, it was pretty brutal. Dave Burns, it would be super cool if we were investing in weatherizing and modernizing our power grid, but that's none of my business. You know what would help in the next phase of our power grid is if we would do fiber to home. Because if we could get fiber broadband to communities, you know, like actual residential areas, like we've been promised for decades, that would help revolutionize our ability to manage the flow of electricity. It seemed to be an incredibly positive experience and a successful experiment in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the Department of Energy invested in the local power company to provide a gigabit fiber to all of the residents of Chattanooga, and it worked so well that the Republicans blocked any measures that would allow for that program to expand outside of Chattanooga, and then conservatives at the federal level made sure that there was no further adoption of municipal or community-funded broadband. And there's another bill. I didn't actually add it to this week's show notes, but yet another bill that is seeking to block states' abilities to manage their own telecommunications infrastructure and to deny communities the ability to build municipal broadband. And that's going to be going up for another vote. It's like we have to fight this fight every 6 months or so. And every time we let one of these little things slip, we get a terrible law fronted by the conservatives that break our ability to improve our own competition for broadband down at the state and local level. So that's pretty great. There's a little extra politics news for you. I'll see if I can find one of the links that actually has the bill in it so you can read up on it. It's tragic. It's yet another terrible piece of potential legislation. And it is something like I've even been sort of talking a little bit, like, is there the ability to create like a broadband co-op for our little condo association? We could run it through the HOA. This law would destroy our ability to just look out for our own telecommunications needs. It's great. It's great. Yeah, Snorkel Bill, all these storms of a century are basically becoming storms of the season. I wholly expect that we're gonna be facing a bit more of that. Simon says Hypno. At least a foldable can be used as a makeshift hat in a downpour. I love it. Yeah, Kavagash Batman is so worth it. Running a PlayStation just to power a Blu-ray player would absolutely kill one of our crate batteries. But if you gotta watch some Batman, you gotta watch some Batman. Dave Burns, HOA fiber somehow sounds super evil. I guess, but for me, it becomes the lesser of two evils. If we set up our own little broadband co-op and we can supply it to all of the members of our condo association, and we could roll that into our HOA fees, to me, that's so much more worth it to get fiber than to deal with Spectrum's copper cable. Again, we're right across from a couple major installations and schools, and like fiber is right across the street, but we're up a hill. Oh no, we're up a hill. That's too difficult to do fiber. Oh, I guess you guys are stuck with Spectrum. So I would much rather deal with my HOA where they're people that I can go and yell at every month. I pay the fees that empower them to sit in a chair and have me yell at them every month than to try and convince Spectrum that we need more than a 20 megabit per second upload. Because that's never going to happen. We're never going to get that. Spectrum would love to sell me a business grade download speed. For all those businesses that need to consume gigabit broadband data speeds, but never need to upload more than 20 megabits per second. So, sure, HOA fiber would be a devil, but it would be one that I would be able to influence and control and yell at. Spectrum isn't going to care if I go to one of their offices and complain about their service. They're genuinely awful. Yeah, Geekmaster, I feel like more people should align this way. Geekmaster says, well, I do lean more to the conservative side. Net neutrality and broadband expansion are two things the Republican Party needs to stop being ignorant about. If you're cloth coat Republican, if you are old school conservative and you care about like business and competition, then these strategies fronted by the current GOP are not in your interests. So it's a very sad state of affairs that we find ourselves in with these kinds of conversations that are now basically just empowering multi-billion-dollar corporations because money is speech and they listen to those campaign contributions more than they listen to their constituents. So, let me get this out of the way here. I also have to a huge shout out to JMan150 with gifting a tier one sub to Flow Tech Wolf and Vulgarity. Thank you so much, JMan. I really appreciate the support on the show and the stream, and for everybody that's tuning in and sharing and supporting and contributing, I really appreciate that too. So that was kind of housekeeping. I had a bunch of stuff published over the last week. I'm going to do a quick rundown on those stories and pieces. But everything that we're going to talk about, we actually have a pretty healthy news block that we need to jump into. Everything that we're going to be linking to is going to be on the show notes for this week's episode on somegadgetguide.com. On somegadgetguide.com, you will also find my video overview on the Hover Air Camera X1. It's a little mini pocket drone. The folks at Hover sponsored this video for me to take it out on a test drive, and it is surprisingly good. It looks like such a toy, but I was able to teach my daughter how to fly this little drone, have it track her, shoot video, do all this fun stuff. And their claims are this is like the easiest way to get up and running with drone video footage. So on a play date, my daughter took this little drone and taught her friend how to fly this little drone. So I feel, and if people want to debate me in the comments here, this is going to be one of the most controversial things I maybe have ever said. But I feel if the company is making claims about this being an easy camera drone to fly, watching a 7-year-old teach another 7-year-old how to fly the drone successfully validates those claims. I feel those claims are accurate. I don't know. I just had to put it out there. You're going to catch the actual video where I talk about the drone without wacky commentary like that. The video is better put together than what I just said. Next up, we did a two-parter. We did a collaboration, cross-channel collaboration. Me and my buddy TK Bay, we finally met up person-to-person, face-to-face, and we really wanted to compare and contrast the different strategies on AR glasses. So there's Rokid and there's X-Real, and we pitted on his channel for part one of the video. We compared the new Rokid Max against the X-Real Air, and then we also, on my channel, compared their new little mini pocket computer brains. So the Rokid Station versus the X-Real Beam. We did a two-parter video, and it was really fun. I mean, for us, just being able to get together, the photo that we took for our thumbnails was out at a Shake Shack. So, you know, we got lunch after, did a holiday Hollywood, you know, business day, and then a business lunch. It was pretty great. But yeah, so two videos back to back, try and catch both of them. TK tackles the glasses. I tackle the way that you power the glasses with these little pocket computer things. And I really feel like this is a blossoming segment of consumer focused portable display. Allow me the brief tangent in what's supposed to be a short housekeeping session here. LG, my former bae when it comes to crazy smartphones that we'll never see ever again in our lifetime. I'm holding up the LG V60. I have the LG V50 over here too. LG just announced, I don't think they've really released it. Let me see if we can find it. I'll try to add this to the show notes too. LG suitcase television. So let me see. No, they're apparently now selling the Stand By Me Go. Is that what this is really called? Oh, this is like a Forbes link. I just want to go directly to the page. It really bothers me how difficult it is to go directly to the company or the manufacturer page on every manufacturer except Apple. Have you noticed that, how terrible search has become? Where if you type in a product name, you'll get a whole bunch of like jerry-rigged SEO articles about the product, but you won't actually get a link until like the third page of search results to go to the website or the manufacturer that makes it, unless it's Apple. And then the first entries in your search are to the Apple page, and then you get the commentary. I'm going to have some critical stuff to say about Apple in this too. So, $999. Here, let's throw this up on screen. $999, and what? Let's look at the specs. No, I want all the specs. And what do we got? Yes, artificial intelligence and content partners. I just want to know, how big, screen size is 27-inch display, 1080p resolution, and a 60 hertz refresh. So a 27-inch screen, that's pretty good, in this little briefcase, and you open up the lid, and the TV is like pointing straight up, and then there's like a little monitor arm that pivots the screen and flattens it out so that you can watch TV anywhere you go. It's got a built-in battery. I want to find the runtime. What is the estimated runtime of the display? I'm missing it. I can't find connectivity, audio, dimensions, weight, general, picture panel. I really don't see it. I really don't see where the estimated battery life and power are. But okay. So I'm kind of making fun of LG here because I feel like this is a solution in search of a problem. And this is one of those products that to me kind of obnoxiously overlooks all of the solutions that we've kind of already used up to this point. So it is cool that you've got a big TV in a briefcase. Awesome. But for $1,000, you are paying for a 27-inch display that is a larger, I've got a 27-inch art monitor right here and the battery built into it, but I feel you could come up with a pretty reasonable facsimile of this experience stepping down to a smaller screen size that would be easier to pack and easier to power with one of your own standalone power banks. Like, on my shelf down here, let me see if I can pull one out without dropping a whole bunch of accessories on the floor. Like, on my shelf right here, I've got numerous, like, 15-inch portable displays. I've got some really pretty OLEDs that are portable. And I also have a really pretty 4K screen that has its own battery built into it. And everyone was saying, like, how ridiculously expensive that sort of part-time, it's almost like a laptop dock. So it's got ports, you can plug into it, you can connect your phone with Ready4 or Honor Magic Desktop, you can hook up other accessories, it's got a keyboard blade so that you can type with a trackpad. And people are like, oh, it's like $500. That's like the most expensive thing ever. And you're like, this is $1,000. It's $1,000 TV. And it's 1080p. So Raymondid is asking what 4K screen I have. I know I'm yelling. I don't need to yell. I have a wireless mic. But just because I wasn't looking at the camera, I felt like I was far away from you. So psychologically, my brain went, oh, for them to be able to hear you when you're on the other side of the office, you should project more. You don't need to do that. Because I the mic is on me. Just how podcasting works, guys. So what I have is the U-Perfect. And this is a 4K panel. It's an LCD. It's not an OLED. And I don't know what the pricing is on it now. When this thing first launched, it was horrifically expensive for the 1080p variant. But this back panel has a battery and a built-in kickstand so that you can kind of like prop it up or flatten it out. And it's got all of these wonderful little ports. You can plug in via USB-C. It's got a headphone output. That's pretty cool. The headphone jack is not great for HDMI audio, but it's functional. And then you can also hook in power and mini HDMI. I always have to think there's micro, mini, and full-sized. I wished it had full-sized HDMI, but then in this panel right here is another battery. So I want to say that the full version of this... Oh, and little speakers. The speakers aren't great either. I would be willing to bet that the LG solution, which does include like a little Bluetooth speaker, probably sounds better than this thing. I mean, and again, you don't have to spend anything more on the LG to get the little Bluetooth speaker. It's bundled with this briefcase, which is also kind of a concern because it's not built into the briefcase, this solution that they're showing with a Bluetooth speaker. I'm sure the TV probably has some OK speakers built in. I don't know. Their specs page is really annoying to look for information on. So I believe the MSRP on that U-Perfect was like $700, but they're so regularly on sale. And if you don't need 4K, then you could get it even cheaper. Oh, sorry, McCorkerin is saying it's on sale right now for $499. So, sorry, that was kind of an extreme tangent. The reason why I'm bringing up the LG TV is for $1,000, the one advantage you would have is having a slightly larger television, 27-inch screen, that you can share with someone else. So that is kind of cool. But if you're looking at some kind of portable display that can do mixed usage, that has 1080p resolution and can project a larger image, you'd probably be better off packing a wearable display. You grab some of these glasses and you put these glasses on your face and you have a 1080p screen, just like the LG, and you can project up to a movie theater size screen floating out in space in front of you. And that's, I feel like, the critical challenge that we're going to have to get, that I wish techies were more involved in this kind of conversation, to try these things out more. Because someone's going to look at like, well, how do I take a screen with me? Oh, look at this really cool briefcase thing. And now you've got this enormous piece of carry-on luggage versus a pair of sunglasses that fit in your pocket. And if you need a display for your own personal use, you've got a better version. You've got a micro OLED powered 1080p screen that can also go up to 120 hertz. So you can also do high refresh on these glasses where you can't do high refresh on the $1,000 LG television. So I want to do more of this coverage because this is a product segment that people are crazy unfamiliar with. like, you show them to other grown-ups and they don't know what to make of a display you put on your face. So I really feel like that needs a lot more attention. And unfortunately, something kind of, you know, exotic like this briefcase television will probably get more mainstream appeal, more mainstream coverage. And it is, oh, it's outlandish. You walk around and you can carry. But I don't like taking my portable monitors out with me anymore because they're bigger than a pair of sunglasses. So the only thing that holds you back is if you're needing to take something to share, then yeah, maybe this works and you could pack this with like an Xbox and you could have like a little portable gaming setup or my Steam Deck plug into that. That'd be really cool. But anything else, and you're like, your dollar to display performance is just way better on a pair of glasses. So yeah. Yeah, McCorkin is saying, yeah, it also swivels into portrait mode, but I guess you can do that with the right kind of case and accessories with the U-Perfect. So the thing that's kind of frustrating about the laptop docks is I don't believe any of them have ever properly supported portrait orientation. So that is a bit of a bummer. That is one thing that, like, the TV will probably do better if it does support tilt and swivel and gives you a vertical orientation. That one has been frustrating because the cool thing about that screen that I just pulled up is that kickstand is really good for lining it up vertically, but nothing seems to talk to the monitors to change the orientation. So it's kind of rough. Dave Burns has already beaten me to the punch with making fun of Apple Vision Pro, but I'm not going to rise to the bait, Dave. We've got housekeeping to finish 40 minutes into the podcast. So short story, incredibly long. TK and I did a collaboration twofer where we talked about augmented reality glasses. On the public blog, I finally published the editorial that I wrote for Patreon. So now it's public. Everyone can read it. You don't have to be on the Patreon. When we all suffer when Apple products don't just work. This is my rant on AirTags and how Apple dropped this privacy hand grenade into the conversation. And no one else can make a competing tracker network. And we have to wait for Apple now to fix iPhones to alert when Android trackers might be in their vicinity, because Apple did not do their due diligence in reaching out to the Bluetooth special interest groups to influence the future builds of Bluetooth 5.2 and Bluetooth 5.3, and we're all paying for it. But at the same time, Google's had to delay their tracker network, and they're waiting for Apple to update the iPhones, which, funnily enough, in this case, Apple isn't updating the iPhone quickly to fix this issue. That's so weird, because the longer Apple waits to fix this issue, the longer we have to wait to buy Android trackers, and everybody can still buy AirTags. So, boy, it just seems to totally work out in Apple's favor to really take their time and delay the market and slow everything down. How weird is that? Weird that Apple would give themselves that kind of crazy advantage on a problem that they caused. So now they get to profit from blowing this up for everybody else. It's funny, after writing this editorial and putting it out public, I've now gotten PR contacts from other companies that are looking to make tracker hardware for the Android system. So whenever we get to play with a location find my network that is better protected than what Apple did with AirTags, hopefully I'll have some fun gear to show off, some alternative trackers to AirTags. So that would be pretty nice, but if you want this full scope, this editorial is probably me at my angriest with Apple over this situation right now. I wrote it in the heat of how incredibly unfair it was, and then 2 weeks later, there was still no resolution to the problem. Like, multiple weeks, there's been no commentary from Apple about, oh no, we're going to get on top of this, we're going to fix this. I know our pals at Google made sure that our problems with AirTags could be fixed for Android users, but we're not going to help Google give us competition. So, F you, we got ours. Just buy your mom an iPhone, and then everything will just work. So there you go. Sorry, I saw a comment from McCorkran. I'm not commenting on anything Linus this week. Talking about one of the most oxygen-sucking stories of the last week, I refuse to participate in something that is not related to me that would just be for clicks on my channel. The number of videos that popped up in my YouTube feed from people like, I just gotta weigh in. Do you have to weigh in? Okay. You contribute to the conversation. That's great. Oh, Gormlord, yeah, I just watched Shannon Morse's video about RCS security and it made me mad about Apple too. Apple's entire business model is break a standard, make it a walled garden proprietary solution for iPhone owners that can't work with the competition, and then blame the competition for things not just working. That's it. Think about everything that doesn't interoperability work between Apple products and everyone else. USB file transfers on Macs, the inability to send a Bluetooth file to an iPhone, messaging standards, communication, end-to-end encryption, all broken if you have to text an Android user, but Apple consistently showcases it as a problem with the others. All of the problems with current Apple right now are because of Apple. And Apple trying to break standards and create proprietary solutions that only benefit the people who have bought the most recent versions of their products. Because the thing with AirTags also affected people who owned older iOS devices. Because we had to wait for those updates, we had to wait for those patches. The potential for harm and abuse was high, even for iPhone owners. Because Apple didn't do it right. They are not a market leader, they are a technology leech. And what they do is they look at what the market is doing and they see how can we break that so that we can sell a different version of it to people that don't do a lot of comparison shopping for their tech purchases. So, I mean, I said the thing, but I didn't talk about it. Ghost Starscream. Also, Juan talked, said the thing he wouldn't talk about. Yeah, I mentioned that I wasn't going to talk about it. It's like, you know, Papa Drac, and like, I don't say blah, 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 except to say that I don't say blah, blah, blah. It's fine. A couple other things went out on the Patreon. I have a video that I don't know when it's going to go public, but it is out now. Moto Ready 4 on Android 13, the best desktop mode, gets a little better. Very encouraging to see some refinement and some little feature UI polish for Ready 4. This is still my favorite desktop mode, and I think it's still the best desktop mode. And then on top of that, this will probably be going out the end of the week. I wrote an article comparing the Pixel tablet against my Robo and Kala to look at a Google-powered Google Slate against Windows on ARM. And it's a completely unfair fight. Like, there's nothing about that competition that is equal. But there are some very interesting things to look at what Google's strategy for a home slate and smart display against Robo and Kala with a Windows on ARM Surface clone. And so you put those two against each other and you can kind of see just how stark the landscape is for a portable slate computing device and what the expectations of those things are too. I think the psychology of it needs to feel good in the hand and have a pretty screen, because that's most of the tablet reviews that I read out there, is woefully insufficient to describe why someone should spend more than a couple $100 on a tablet. So 50 minutes into the podcast, there's housekeeping. Dave Byrne, still wrong, Juan. The bestest desktop mode is iPad OS. I mean, it's silly to me that you're going to go out and buy a laptop powerful slate and then are like, it can only run like 6 apps. Why would you need to run, have multitasking? It's just 6 apps. So, boy, howdy, do we have a pretty healthy news block, and I wanted to spend some time talking about the Hurricane, so I knew that my structure for the show was going to be lopsided. So everything that we're going to link to and talk about, SomeGadgetGuy.com, this week's show notes, I've got all the links listed out there, especially if you're coming back to this for the replay crew or if you're listening to the audio version of the podcast. I'm not doing 3 hours, Dave, but this show's going to run a little long. First up, we've got some lawsuit news. This one I thought was pretty interesting. I'm catching this from The Hollywood Reporter. AI-created art is not copyrightable, judge says in ruling that could give Hollywood studios pause. More than 100 days into the writer's strike, fears have kept mounting over the possibility of studios deploying generative artificial intelligence to completely pen scripts. But intellectual property law has long said that copyrights are only granted to works created by humans, and that doesn't look like it's changing anytime soon. A federal judge on Friday upheld a finding from the U.S. Copyright Office that a piece of art created by AI is not open to protection. The ruling was delivered in an order turning down Stephen Thaler's bid, challenging the government's position refusing to register works made by AI. Copyright law has, quote, never stretched so far to, quote, protect works generated by new forms of technology operating absent any guiding human hand, U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell found. So this is an incredibly complex legal debate, because on top of everything that we're going to be talking about with new technologies coming forward for these types of like language learning models and generative art models, our copyright law is just crazy messed up right now. It is an antiquated bedrock of protections for the companies that have been able to influence politicians the most. It is fundamentally broken in how it is enforced, and doesn't do what it purports to do in protecting the rights of content creators, more so protecting the profits of massive corporations that sell and distribute the art created by humans. So there are a number of problematic elements to coming out with a ruling that says, hey, this can't work, or this can't be copyrighted. But on the same token, the argument for AI is, we want to screw humans. I'm a massive media conglomerate, and what I would like to do is pay fewer humans to write scripts and shoot the intros to our fancy shows and edit these special effects. So we want to cut more humans out of the production chain. So we're going to use this technology to do it. But we also want to be able to protect our content from being used by other people. So we want to screw people, but we also want our content to be protected. So the one positive out of all of this is it at least interrupts a chain of an argument from a massive corporation. Go use the AI tools. Do it. But you can't put a copyright on it. If the machine learning just absorbed the intellectual property of a whole bunch of human artists, you don't get to then put copyright on that content. So ultimately, this is a net positive. The incredibly minute legal wrangling and definitions and arguments, and it's probably going to go to another appeal. We're going to have to fight this case by case by case, work by work by work, piece by piece by piece. We're a ways before we can count on this to set some kind of precedent that would actually protect the rights of artists, that would actually protect the income and the content of the human who creates the art. And it's going to be ratcheted by the corporations that employ humans to make art to then sell. This entire thing gets really messy and really complicated. But at least for this one ruling, we have the beginnings of an argument to say what you're doing or what you're making using these tools needs to have the guiding hand of a human. And you're going to see it incredibly ratcheted, where now Disney's commentary, like look at the opening credits, the thing I alluded to for Secret Invasion. There was all the outroar. Oh, they used AI to make this credit sequence. And then Disney very, very quickly, oh, no, 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 it was humans made the intro. They just used a few AI tools to make it more intro-y. But humans, we used the humans. We didn't use, the AI didn't make it. And it's exactly because of cases like this. So it's going to change the temperament and the tone of a lot of these conversations. And if people are going, well, wait a minute. If you need humans to make this stuff to make it copyrightable, why are we investing all this money in AI? So these AI tools will hopefully be better refined. I have no problems with giving artists better tools to create stuff. Like, content aware fill is always this argument that people bring up. Well, the artist didn't really make that if they did content aware fill. It's like, no, content aware fill just took a whole bunch of tedium out of like a cloning tool, right? Was the artist really being artistic if they're trying to paint out part of a background? No, no, they weren't. That is not the same as, well, I went to DeviantArt and I sucked up all of this IP from all these other people, and then I trained a piece of software to copy all of those different art styles, and then I type into a prompt, give me furry, you know, action comic, and then it made a whole furry action comic and wrote it and did panels and storyboards and everything for me. That's obviously a gulf of difference between content aware fill and the entire creative generative piece being dumped out at the end. Let me take a quick drink of coffee here and we're gonna come right back.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Let's see, doesn't this ruling help in the protection of the writers' jobs? I mean, I would assume so. This ruling specifically is one data point, one legal argument. It needs to now be tested in court, and limits need to be defined around that. We've got a ways to go in how you build a legal precedent. And at some point, we'll probably have to talk about specific laws for how this stuff is managed and maintained. Go Starscream, if AI art can't be copyrighted, does this mean that Bard ChatGPT can't also be copyrighted? No, that is different. So the software that does the learning is created by people and runs on a machine, and that software can be copyrighted. What you put into that machine and what it learns from and then what it creates cannot be copyrighted. So again, you have to separate the art from the artist. Pacostin, we used humans. Sounds like some Futurama joke. Authentic errors in your construction because we used real people, not just machines. So, Diago, this is an interesting question. What happens when a human creator, say a Nobel laureate, to sell all his music work to a company? Are we still protecting the rights of the creator? I don't know what you mean. Like, is there a Nobel Prize for music? But when we start talking about catalogs of content, we have different rules for owning and licensing copyrighted works. So if a human, say a singer, says, I've got this catalog of music and I would like to just sell it. And so they are giving the rights of publishing, distributing, and advertising that content to another company. And then that company can do whatever they want with it. That, I mean, you gave them the license to do that. Again, if you really want to read up on like music industry case law, you should follow Taylor Swift's career, because it is an interesting myriad path of she owns this, but she doesn't own that. And now we see that manifest with her re-recording her older albums and her fans going, no, I want what she will get paid from, not what another company owns. So again, it's the exact recording is owned by one company, but the rights to republish and re-record her music are still owned by her. So it's a very complex licensing situation. Bob Dylan. Okay. So if Bob Dylan wants to sell off all his music, he can? Or if the estate who owns... I'm sorry, I don't even know if Bob Dylan is still with us. That is terrible. I am awful. But yeah, so that is a different situation. If someone wants to like say, hey, take my entire musical catalog and you can do whatever you want to it. You could feed it to an AI, that's great. But when you feed that to the AI, what the AI creates cannot be copyrighted. So that's how all the pieces kind of work, at least from my limited understanding of copyright law. this was like, there was one other piece of this that, I also want to, hold on, let me, so if I go to youtube.com, do I have my blank search page? No, so my youtube.com is blank on my phone, but it's still giving me suggestions here on youtube.com. But Patrick H. Willems, and for another sort of conversation about AI, generative art, and filmmaking, what I would recommend, I felt like this was a really heartfelt and emotional appeal to the artistic creation of film. AI filmmaking is not the future, it's a grift, from Patrick H. Willems. I don't always agree with the contrarian take on Patrick H. Willems, like, let me tell you why this movie everyone thinks sucks is actually kind of amazing. But this is a guy who went and made a fan film, sort of like, what if Wes Anderson made an X-Men movie? He got out a camera, he got his friends together, and he made this little sort of loving mashup. And now there's this trend in AI content generation where people are making these, what if Wes Anderson made this kind of movie, or what if Wes Anderson made that kind of movie, entirely using AI tools. And I found myself nodding along with some of his critique about why the joke kind of works, but it kind of doesn't. So when you watch one of these, oh, what if Wes Anderson made The Lord of the Rings? And you're watching it, but it doesn't quite stick the landing on what makes that funny if you're a fan of film, if you really enjoy Wes Anderson films. If you just sort of know that Wes Anderson is a filmmaker who has a very distinct style, the joke is funny. But if you really watch it, you're like, wait a minute, this isn't actually... like, that's not what would be funny about a Wes Anderson version of The Lord of the Rings. Like, the AI doesn't really get it right. And I found myself listening to Willems kind of explain why and break it down piece by piece and sort of dig into it as someone who loved Wes Anderson enough to make his own original what if Wes Anderson made an X-Men movie, and why he chose the sort of template and the look and the topic that he did. And I found myself really agreeing with him on that one. So I would highly recommend checking out this one if you're a film nerd like I am. It explains a lot why this AI stuff isn't really quite as clever as people seem to think it is. Yeah, Dave Burns, it's a part of it. His storylines are as unique as his cinematography. If you really want to stick the landing on the joke, you've got to do more than just copy-paste Bill Murray's face into an AI-generated version of Gandalf. Like, it's more than that, and it's funnier than that when it's more than that. And I don't know. Again, for one, I just really appreciate that Wes Anderson is a part of this conversation to the degree that he is, but it is also kind of lame when you look at, like, how good enough AI tools are. Because they're not really good. They're not really doing stuff that's good. They're doing stuff that's, that's good enough. Okay, moving right along. I was ranting. I've been ranting for a couple months now about how terrible Apple has been with AirTags. And it sparked some conversation online, especially on X. Some people really felt like they needed to defend Apple against my crazy ramblings and my baseless accusations. And it really drove home the point that a lot of people who look at something like AirTags fundamentally do not understand how the technology works or what the relationships are. And people saying, well, the problem's Bluetooth. So what Apple needs to do is make a proprietary wireless standard, and then you'll be able to fix it. And you're like, nah, that's not how standards work. What I would love to see is Apple test that in the market. Don't use Bluetooth or Wi-Fi for the underpinnings of any of your products. So let's see how well that goes. Other people were saying, oh, people are just mad because Apple didn't... So one person, what did they say? I don't want to go digging through X and giving them another click when I don't need to. It was something along the lines of, I just find it interesting that people are criticizing Apple for using ultra wideband instead of Bluetooth. And you're like, that's not why we're criticizing Apple. And that's also fundamentally not how AirTags work, because they use the ultra wideband as one radio and they use low power Bluetooth for everything else. So again, it's like the fog of Apple marketing misinforming someone who claimed to be like an online tech reviewer, jumping into this conversation to correct me about the Bluetooth when they really didn't understand how the product worked. And to them, they were just sort of buying into the, it's Apple magic. So that was like five tweets. But it works really great in my region. Okay, cool. But you understand that Apple is preventing you from trying an Android version of this, where in your region of the world, there's like a 5-to-1 difference in Android users to iPhone users. So if your AirTags work really well, don't you think the Android tags would work even better? Oh, but that's different because Apple insecurity. Well, Apple insecurity is kind of not a thing. You know, they purposely break messaging security for their own users. Because remember, those of us on RCS, now we've rolled out end-to-end encryption in Google Messages. So we're actually doing well. It's only iPhone to Android where Apple is purposely breaking the security of that for their own users. But it turns out, in Apple making all of their little wireless standards easier to use, they really haven't done their due diligence in protecting their own customers. This doesn't affect me. This affects people who own iPhones, because Apple is marketing privacy and security, but they're not really living it. So this is a story by way of TechCrunch, written up by Lorenzo Franceschi. I have no idea how to pronounce that last name. I am sorry. At Lorenzo FB. This $70 device can spoof an Apple device and trick you into sharing your password. So at DEF CON, someone started walking around with, it looks like a Raspberry Pi with like a little Wi-Fi and Bluetooth radio plugged into it. And apparently for like $70 worth of hardware and a little bit of programming know-how, they can send out far-reaching signals off of Bluetooth that mimic and spoof other Apple devices that could encourage people to log into accounts or to connect to different devices. And it all looks totally legit. There is nothing to suggest that the setup would in any way compromise their security or their privacy. And it's a little bit of social engineering that if Apple were really securing the pairing process of their products, like, for example, one of the examples they give is connecting to an Apple TV. And then you can make it look like, oh, we need you to log into this for security. And it looks just like an Apple TV. You've completely spoofed that connection protocol because it's just so easy. And on top of that, this is compounded by the fact, iPhones do dumb things when you try to turn off wireless radios. So a lot of consumers are going to swipe through their control panel, tap the little Bluetooth icon, and they're like, okay, well, it's done. No, that was like a placebo toggle. It's like the button at a lot of crosswalks. It doesn't really do what you think it does. It doesn't sever the connection. It just sort of like, okay, well, we're just going to kind of turn it off, but not really. So this is a mess. And I really wish that, you know, I really hope that there aren't things like this that are actively being deployed, because this is stupid easy. And there doesn't seem to be any sort of signage from Apple to point to, this is not an authentic Apple product that you're connecting to. So you could walk around and just spoof this and say, hey, you want to connect to this network, or you want to connect to an Apple TV or another Apple product. And, oh, for security, we've got to do this. And can we get your password? And then you've moved that person through the process. But it looks just as easy as any other It Just Works Apple device. And there is no authenticity. There is no key from Apple saying, this is an Apple-certified Bluetooth device that you're pairing this to. You're connecting to this, and there's no authentication beyond that. So a lot of people are, oh, but that's a problem with Bluetooth. And you're like, it's really not. I mean, Bluetooth is ugly, and it's kind of miserable. And if you need to dig through settings and menus, I get why people don't want to do that. But when it comes to security, the most recent revisions to the Bluetooth stack, we're at Bluetooth 5.3 now, actually taken a lot of this into account. What never seems to work is when a company puts a proprietary skin on top of this process to make it easier, we leave these huge gaps in the actual security of that relationship. If Apple can't live up to their own marketing standards and their own claims of privacy and security and making products that just work and really take into account the market. Not, this isn't like altruism. They should make their competitors' products better. No, they should make their own products to the standard that they advertise. And they are not doing that. I feel we're getting to the point where Apple is making this so much worse and so much more difficult that they should be barred from using standards. If they can't work with the Bluetooth special interest group, they should not be allowed to use Bluetooth. If they're going to keep putting crap on top of Bluetooth that doesn't work the way that they claim it does, they should be held accountable by regulators, and the FCC should be getting involved at some point. This stuff is like the basics. When you're a $3 trillion market cap brand and you sell 50% of the phones in North America, this isn't a, oh, but they'll figure it out. You don't get the luxury of launching a problem at scale. You should be held to that kind of accountability for the incredible amount of potential harm and abuse that can come from making these kinds of boneheaded mistakes. It's getting ridiculous that we keep trying to jump through hoops to excuse terrible product launches. But Apple is my grandmother's familiar with the iOS and it's intuitive. So I'm going to make excuses for them where I would criticize Google for doing the exact same thing. And Microsoft. Microsoft is bad. This is horse poop. This is the dumbest thing ever. Oh, I'm going to drink some more coffee. My favorite thing about that, too, is also the equity of they ripped off Tile's business model with AirTags. Again, they gave themselves a preferential advantage that they would never have given to another competitor. But when I uninstall the Tile app, I just uninstalled the app. If I try to turn off
Find My on my iPhone, I get a warning. But this is a part of how you find your device. And I say, okay, I still want to opt out. And then I get an email. Oh, you turned off Find My. If someone steals your phone, they can wipe your phone and use your phone. It is no longer protected by Apple with your password. Why is that? I put a password and encrypted my iPhone, and the only way that my iPhone will stay protected is if I'm a part of your location tracking network? No. My password should encrypt the phone and brick the phone if someone tries to wipe it. It should not be dependent on your location tracking wireless network. That's not okay. But it's like I got a twofold. Oh, I can't believe you turned off the cert. There's nothing we can do to help you. You're just lost in the wild, my poor child. You need to trust Apple with every bit of your information and your data and your location. And that should be against the law. Yeah, it's pretty dumb. All right, so we got a trio of Twitter stories that just make me increasingly depressed. Twitter's been rolling out a sort of paid scam. It's a pay to prevent eventually, maybe, potentially get paid. That's sort of a pyramid scheme or some other type of scam that I can't think of the name of right now. But you have to be paying for Twitter Blue, and then if your tweets get enough traffic, Twitter will pay you, even though they're almost about to break even with advertisers leaving the platform. Unfortunately, it seems like the majority of accounts that are starting to get this little trickle of income are like terrible alt-right, fascist, neo-Nazi kinds of accounts. And it's not a great look for the platform. So if you're using Twitter, you have to know that if you're paying for Blue, you're contributing to the dialogue of the alt-right and of like literal self-proclaimed neo-Nazis. And if you're an advertiser on Twitter, you are putting money into the hands of people who are actively trying to subvert conversations with misinformation and are trying to hurt people on this platform. There's really no way around that at this point. I tweeted the podcast out today because I'm earnestly asking people to chill their use on Twitter. And if you encounter ads from companies that are advertising on Twitter, maybe send them a message like, hey, I'm not going to be buying your product or service so long as you are engaging with the alt-right. And it's getting so bad that Twitter, in their own weird way, is starting to acknowledge like they have a problem stitching advertising next to the tweets of alt-right practitioners. So this is by way of Ars Technica, written up by Ashley Bellinger. X suspends pro-Nazi account after two brands halt advertising. And Twitter's solution will be to allow brands to block ads from appearing next to specific profiles. So if you're a brand and you pay Twitter to advertise on their platform, you have to go through and see where your ads end up. And if you see that your ad is stitched next to a tweet from a neo-Nazi, then you can choose to block that account from having your ads associated with it. On a platform that is now voraciously exploding with bots and with people who have been banned from Twitter in the past being brought back into the fold, that to me sounds like a very inefficient process that companies, I don't think, are going to get a lot of benefit out of. And unfortunately, we're going to go with the flow of how the platform should be automated. And then when they get pushback from someone on Twitter saying, hey, I saw your ads next to this guy talking about some really horrific stuff, oh, we'll go and block that guy. That doesn't work. That's completely backwards. Instead, if they're looking at like kind of campaigns and stuff like that, you would want a better team of people at the platform to do their job as it pertains to EU regulations in stemming the flow of this kind of speech. But two companies now leaving because of this type of branding and advertising strategy is insufficient.
The momentum at Twitter is still carrying people through using Twitter first in this kind of microblogging way. And Twitter is not earnestly responding to these claims. They're not earnestly trying to fix what's going on with their platform. They still have not repopulated the team of employees they had to manage the user-submitted issues with other accounts, or the accounts that are propagating misinformation. I mean, all of these things should be getting Twitter incredible fines in the EU and should be getting Twitter delisted from platforms, because one of their strategies here is they want you to be forced to look through content. Like, they want an algorithm feeding you content. And the people that they're paying on that list are a lot of awful people, but they're paying those people to engage in creating terrible content because it gets people upset. And when people are upset, they will stay on Twitter longer to argue or to try and shame Elon Musk. He has no shame. Or, you know, if you're angry and you're afraid, you will spend more time on a social media platform than if you're happy. So they are actively waging psychological warfare against their users and paying misinformation folks to contribute to that psychological warfare. And when they're getting called out on it, one of Musk's potential solutions is to remove your ability to block accounts. So this probably won't happen because you need to have some kind of user protection mechanism on your social media platform, or Google and Apple will delist your app from their respective app stores. But, you know, Tesla owners of Silicon Valley, okay, I'm sure they're big fans of Elon Musk, tweeted out, is there ever a reason to block versus mute someone? And Elon Musk replies, block is going to be deleted as a feature except for DMs. So if you had a list of accounts that were harmful to your mental health and you had them all blocked, well, Elon Musk doesn't think that you should be able to do that. So if at some point there, he's probably going to try this. Right now, I think it's a coin flip. I think it's literally a 50-50 whether or not Musk actually tries to do this, because he is such a he is not an earnest participant in any of this. He is always looking for whatever will get sort of the shock or the outrage. And it's only up until the threat of significant financial penalties and the potential delisting on platforms like the Apple App Store that he'll in any way kind of rein in, oh, so that's why Twitter originally did it that way. Okay, that makes sense. But he's never a truthful, honest, or earnest participant. So I think it's 50-50. I think he might try this and say, oh, but no, you can mute accounts, but you were just going to remove this block feature and we'll make it a part of Twitter Blue so that you can pay me to not see the tweets of horrible alt-right individuals. But if you just want to mute those accounts, you can mute those accounts, and those accounts can still see what you do and keep track of what you talk about and react and respond to their followers about what you might say, especially for like journalists. Journalists don't want to be cut out of the alt-right conversation, I'm sure. So if those accounts want to like dox a journalist, they should be allowed to do that, and the journalist should not be allowed to block them, but they can just kind of mute some of those tweets so they don't see them in their feed. So they don't know what's going on from terrible, awful people that regularly threaten harm on others. That's pretty great. And if you want to do that, I mean, you just got to pay. And isn't that getting a little tiring? I have friends who are kind of in that media education space, like they're YouTube gurus. They talk about like how to get the most out of these platforms. And isn't it getting a little old? If you want your tweets to really be seen by the people who follow you, you just got to pay Twitter. If you want to be able to sort of organize your feed or write longer tweets, you just got to pay Twitter. If you'd like, you know, the algorithm to support your content better, you just got to pay Twitter. If you want to block horrible neo-Nazis who get paid to be on the platform while you're not getting paid to be on the platform, you just got to pay Twitter.
like, at what point do folks at least consider the potential of examining their behavior to say, I'm not okay with that, and maybe I shouldn't be paying Twitter to be more and more awful to me? Oh, but I gotta have that blue check mark. Do you? Do you really? Is that what you need? Is that really giving you the benefit for your work and your job? Is it somehow authenticating that you are you when someone could also just go pay for a blue Twitter check mark and kind of copy your account? At what point do our friends in the tech space say, this isn't good for us and it's continuing to get worse? And at what point do our friends in the tech space look at the equity of this type of business practice and say, this is terrible for everybody? Why are we continuing to support it? So I tweeted this podcast out today. I got like a couple of retweets on it. I am actively telling you to stop supporting this and go anywhere else that you would like to engage with microblogging and to talk about these kinds of fun experiences. Someone shared another report on science Twitter. So you had like climate change Twitter and black Twitter and tech Twitter and all these, you know, like we've built these little pocket communities on a platform. Someone mentioning like, hey, there was this humongous brain drain on science Twitter and climate change Twitter and politics Twitter. And like some of these things, InfoSec, that was the other one. So people who were talking about like information security and like, you know, data privacy and stuff like that, the community of people who were sharing that kind of content on Twitter is now almost completely gone. So if you were on Twitter following accounts to engage in conversations about security, that community almost completely evaporated. Same thing with science Twitter, climate change Twitter. We're seeing significant drops up until the API changes took place. So data lasts until, I want to say, April. And then in May, there's like a steep, there's a stark separation. So now you can't see who has left Twitter and what conversations are just gone, because you have to pay ridiculous amounts of money for the API access to just search on Twitter. But a good chunk of those folks ended up on other social media platforms. A good chunk of those folks ended up on Blue Sky, created accounts on Mastodon. Now they're playing with Threads. And I gotta tell you, every single week I bring this up, I have 1,600 followers on Threads. I've got 16,000 followers on Twitter, and I just bumped up to 640 followers on Mastodon. Now, using all three of those platforms, which platform do you think I get the best, honest, human-to-human engagement with the things that I post and the comments that I reply to? Yeah, it's Mastodon, because there's not an algorithm standing on my neck. Occasionally, something will take off on Threads. I can't figure out why or what. It's just something the algorithm says, hey, this will be popular, and it seems to send it out to more of my followers. Cool. But consistently, I get regular interactions, regular comments and replies, and I'm having more fun talking to the nerds on Mastodon. It is easy to set up. It's easy to pick a server now. You have the old school world of like picking different apps. You remember how fun it was? You'd go to Twitter and like, the Twitter app kind of sucks. The Twitter app is kind of sucking again. And now you can go like, I like Tusky, but the new official Mastodon app just got a refresh and it looks really pretty. And there are all these other options and you can play with some of these. And then on your web browser, you can say, do I want a Twitter-like layout, or do I want a Google Plus-like layout, or do I want a multiple page advanced layout? Like, I can for free get a TweetDeck layout for Mastodon. It's all just built in there. So my recommendation is, if you're a nerd and you really like nerding out on this stuff, there's this little pocket that's empty for consumer tech and consumer Android conversations. We've got a ton of people talking about science. We've got a ton of people talking about coding, developing, app development, FOSS software, you know, hacking ROMs, like the really high level stuff.
But there's this huge vacuum for just talking about the phone and the hardware and the reviews and all that fun stuff. And let me tell you, there is an audience there that is kind of thirsty for that kind of content. And you do not have Elon Musk's algorithm stomping on your neck, demanding payment just for your tweets to be seen. But at some point, someone's going to have to look at their follower count and say, the couple thousand followers I have on Twitter, oh, I can't let those go. So what am I going to do? Because right now, the situation at X is horrifically unsustainable. And if you want any other evidence to suggest that what is happening at Twitter is in violation of every philosophy in sharing content and social media, the last story on our Twitter lineup, Elon Musk's X is throttling traffic to websites he dislikes. The site formerly known as Twitter added a 5-second delay when a user clicked on a shortened link to the New York Times, Facebook, and other sites Musk commonly attacks. Company formerly known as Twitter has been slowing the speed with which users could access links to the New York Times, Facebook, and other news organizations and online competitors, a move that appeared targeted at companies that have drawn the ire of Elon Musk. Users who clicked a link on Musk's website, now called X, for one of the targeted websites, were made to wait about 5 seconds before seeing the page, according to tests conducted Tuesday by the Washington Post. So they're also trying to game the traffic of anything that might potentially encourage someone to look at content off of Twitter. Which, again, if we had stronger regulatory control and we had things like net neutrality protections, we could build on net neutrality to say, that's the F illegal. But again, the Trump administration with Ajit Pai got rid of and completely destroyed the functional capability of the FCC to protect us against exactly these kinds of shenanigans. So that sucks. He's like, even if you're paying for Twitter Blue, there is a potentially a very good chance that your content is also getting throttled. If you share a shortened link to something like Mastodon, Elon Musk is trying to make it look like Mastodon is a painfully slow service. They'll put a delay. And also, if it sees a Mastodon link, chances are really good that it's getting stomped on by the algorithm anyway. So I've kind of taken to sideways, like, hey, if you guys want to have a conversation, here's my follow me links on my own website. But I doubt that anyone ever really gets to see those.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
What's up, everybody? This is Eric the Tech Preacher from Easy Computer Solutions. So if you love technology and you want to go deep and in depth about smartphones, tablets, computers, smartwatches, and more, check me out on YouTube. Open up YouTube.com or open up the YouTube app on your favorite smartphone or tablet and type in The Tech Preacher and join my community. Also, I have a live stream every Wednesday night that's called Wired Wednesday, where we talk about all things tech. I have an amazing group of people that's on my panel where we go deep and talk about the realness about technology. So come join my awesome community of techies on Easy Computer Solutions. Remember, I'm the tech preacher. So I want to thank Juan Carlos Bagnell for allowing me the opportunity to be on this short clip. So, Juan, back to you.
So I haven't gotten to the point where, unfortunately, because of the nature of my business, I am keeping a Twitter account open. But my usage of Twitter has dramatically fallen off. And for a number of the conversations that I still have, like, what I use it for the most is just trying to, in DMs, get people to contact me on others. Excuse me, I got a little bit of coffee grounds in my throat. I did not do a good job prepping coffee today. Where I try and get people to
chat with me on other platforms. Either can we move this conversation to email, or do you have a Telegram account? Actually, the last four DMs, excuse me, that I sent to people were all that, basically just, hey, do you mind if we move this somewhere else? So it's pretty awful. I am being a little sentimental. I'm holding on to my Twitter account just as sort of the museum piece of the Twitter stuff that I've made. And at some point, I'll also have to pull the trigger on just walking away. I had some business relationships from sponsored content that depended on a social media strategy that now increasingly I'm trying to work against in my future contracts. It sucks because, like, a part of this is like, hey, we want to do this and we want to promote this content and we want to share it. And to PR people, they're going to be the last ones to make any kind of substantive change in their strategies. What they want are impressions. Like, impressions aren't even like views or clicks. It's like the potential for this to have been seen by X number of people. And it's the worst strategy because it really devalues what actual relationships look like on social media. It is a grotesquely inefficient and misrepresentative metric for judging the success of a campaign, but that's what they want to see. What was the reach and what were the impressions? It doesn't matter. What mattered was, did you give me a link that we could track that people clicked on? What matters to me is action. But unfortunately, a lot of these social media campaigns kind of devolve into that, so or revolve around that. So it's no, I kind of had it right the first way. They kind of devolve into that. So I'm having a blast, and I'm talking to a lot of folks on Mastodon, and it's really fun. Jump into Mastodon, follow a hashtag, play some games. I love it. Like, there's an account I follow that, like, every day at a certain time they put out a new hashtag challenge, and it's stupid stuff, and it's hilarious. Like, one of the ones I got, like, a surge of new followers out of was, like, your least favorite song. And I said, Starship, we built this city on rock and roll. And not only do I not like that song, but boy, howdy, is that video just terrible. And got into music conversations galore, and it was wonderful, and I loved it. And doing similar things on Twitter, that kind of interaction, that old school social media, I'm literally just hanging out and talking to people, is basically dead. So I'm going to keep bringing it up. I wish more people would sort of follow some of that, like, experience. It is really galling that, like, a few of the techies that I've tried to sort of bring over, like, they'll post once or twice, and then it's like, okay, well, I guess nothing happened, so Mastodon isn't for me. And I, you know, if you'd use it for just a bit, I think you would have so much fun. But, again, it's leading a horse to water, but we can't make him drink. And I really am disappointed, because it's exactly the same failure that happened with me on Reddit, where Glowing Rectangles was just a miserable failure of a project, because creators didn't want to take the second to not only share their content, but click the up arrow on other people's content. So all this talk you get from, like, the YouTube gurus, like, get in there and collaborate and work together, and a rising tide floats all boats. It doesn't really work. If you really work your ass off to try and develop a system or a platform to help other people, if it doesn't immediately give them something, they won't invest. They won't really support it or participate. It's like, well, I tooted once on Mastodon, and then I wasn't super popular, and I didn't get a million followers, so I guess it's not for me. Like, okay. Twitter's going to keep screwing you, but I guess it's fine. Threads is a Facebook product. We know that's not going to be equitable, but cool. All right. So, yeah. Pretty rough. Let me take a drink of water. I'm done with my coffee because apparently I was swallowing coffee grounds at the end of that. So, we had two gadget block stories. I might actually almost get us to 2 hours getting through all of the news and stuff, but with just front-loading the rambliness of me talking about a hurricane. One, just the buyer beware. I've held these up so many times in videos, and I'm so mad, and I am, like, knock on wood, nothing has happened to me yet, but the continued chatter and the regular issues that people are now demonstrating, man, am I disappointed with SanDisk. So this is by way of Sharon Harding over at Ars Technica. SanDisk Extreme SSDs are, quote, worthless. Multiple lawsuits against WD say. So on Thursday, two more lawsuits were filed against Western Digital over its SanDisk Extreme Series and MyPassport portable SSDs. That brings the number of class action complaints filed against Western Digital to 3 in 2 days. I was ahead of the curve with Western Digital enclosures. If you're running a WD box, get rid of it as efficiently as you can. I have one down there that is the... So I bought a Western Digital NAS. Four bay, four hard drives in there. It died. And again, all of your data gets... It's encrypted to that box. I mean, again, it's kind of a protection, but also like, oh, the enclosure was not very well built, so I got another one. This is the third one, and now it started having issues where it wouldn't complete firmware updates. The display stopped functioning. I don't know why this NAS needs this little ticker display to give you information about what's going on with the NAS, but when it starts to get futzy, you also know, like, that's about to die. And again, it's always a bad look when a giant box that holds your hard drives to help with part of your data backup strategy stops taking firmware updates. Danger Will Robinson. So this was years ago. I bought a little 3-drive QNAP as like what I thought was going to be kind of like a temporary. Like, I just need something. I need some big hard drives in a box. And this has been running for years without any kind of significant interruption, any significant downtime. I've been running regular firmware updates. It's gone through 2 major OS updates for what actually drives the software on the box. And actually, the newest version of their operating system, when you pull it up in a browser, is like, I'm looking at a beautiful Linux distro. This is really nice for just giant box of hard drives. So I was ahead of that curve. I liked Western Digital drives, like the actual spinning disk platters, but their enclosures suck so bad. Oh, the other one. My uncle got a 2-drive Western Digital enclosure that it was only USB. It wasn't a NAS. But he couldn't transfer his music collection to this 2-drive hard drive because it would overheat. It was just like, it looked kind of like a squared off version of the Apple Mac Pro Diaper Genie. So it's just like 2 drives in a vertical sort of rectangular squarish, and it has a fan that vents out the top. And the 2 drives were packed in so tight in this little enclosure that transferring, I think at the time he was like, my music collection was like 100 gig. Trying to make it through 100 gigabyte file transfer caused the box to overheat, lock up, fail. What do you do? How do you do that? How do you make a device that can't handle that kind of file transfer? So, it was only until pretty recently that I even knew SanDisk had been acquired by Western Digital. I might have brought it up on a previous instance of the podcast and then promptly forgotten that one company had purchased another. But I've got 4 of these. And these are the little SanDisk Extreme SSDs. And I use them in very short bursts. So one of my favorite things to do is take one of these, load up all of like my video templates, content files, music. I don't put a lot of music on my videos, but I've got like a little library of YouTube-approved licensed music. And when I go out on the road, I just carry one of these, and it's got all of the content that I need to sort of stitch into or make thumbnails, do all that stuff. I can plug it into a phone, I can plug it into a laptop, I can move that stuff around. But I've never really worked off of the drives. If, apparently, part of the issue is working off of the drives get to a state where they just kind of give up and then nuke everything on the drive. So I can't proclaim with confidence that my style of use won't eventually fail. Because a number of people have now been complaining about sort of mixed use or lots of photo backups or video backups. And you're like, okay, if you need to dump a whole bunch of footage on the drive in the field, that's very problematic. If, oh no, I moved over an entire 256 gig memory card of footage from my Sony camera to this drive and it's dead. You know, like, so I can't say for certain that my limited style of use is protecting me in any way. At any point, I feel like even I, in a very sort of streamlined way, could get to a point where this thing just evaporates. And then I also have a couple of these where I keep like a backup, so I can have two drives in tandem. I like redundancy. But then I also have a couple of these drives where I've used them just to store long-term content, and now I need to go back through and make sure that just the drive sitting dormant at some point, they won't fail from there either. So this is that thing where now we've got to look after our family and friends. Got to say, hey, is anyone using these little drives? There's a couple class actions going on. Double check your data that it hasn't been destroyed by the drives. And we need to look at some of the other solutions for portable storage on the go. If it's a Samsung drive, I think LaCie is doing some like more like industry grade portable data solutions. And then also, I want to play with just getting a portable enclosure for an SSD and just see, like, is that any better? It might be, you know, like, could it be better from, like, a dollar per gigabyte kind of solution? Maybe it's not as built as rugged as this little plastic enclosure for an SSD, but maybe it's cheaper to get an enclosure and an SSD. I'd need to crunch the numbers on it. But that's a bummer. That really makes me upset. And I feel like this is one of those that we bring up because now we need to warn other people because Western Digital has not done a very good job of reaching out to their consumers. If there is a potential issue with these drives, they're kind of playing the let's keep it quiet, let's just deal with this on a case by case. And I think they posted something on like a user forum. Oh yeah, look out for these drives with these serial numbers and maybe you need a firmware update. And then people ran the firmware update and more people were using the drives again, and it seemed to fail just as bad. So their solution was also woefully insufficient. And that's the thing, like, the entire reputation of this label with this company is just vanishing. Like, I've got SanDisk memory cards. They've been bulletproof. These have been some really good memory cards. I have to believe they are different forks of the SanDisk label. Like, what SanDisk puts into their professional-grade memory cards is vetted by a different team, and it's a different kind of QA than what they're doing with these SSD enclosures. So it's pretty crappy. It's really bad. Oh, Barry Johnson, Western Digital, I thought you were just bad. Why are you getting worse? Cedric Owens, knock on wood, but my shucked drives from their easy stores have been in my Unraid server. I've got Western Digital drives in my QNAP. I pulled some of those out of my WD enclosures. So I have three 10 terabyte drives imaged to look like a 20 terabyte storage. And the QNAP with those Western Digitals has been great. But I am looking, because I've just got years, I've got over a decade of like 1080p and 4K archival footage. And I'm a pack rat. I can't get rid of it all. I'm looking at switching over to the new Seagate 20 terabyte Iron Wolves. And so over the next year, I'm going to start replacing those drives and I'm going to try and double the entire capacity of my little three drive NAS. It's been such a badass little enclosure. I mean, really, if you can step up to small business grade gear, it's so nice. It was the first link in our home network chain that had a 10 gigabit. Let's try that again. It was the first link in our chain that had a 10 gigabit network connection on it. And so I got a switch and I got a router that all supported 10 gigabit Ethernet. And it is so nice. It is so nice. Even if you're over a Wi-Fi 6 connection, you just have so much local bandwidth to move big files, and I can work directly off of my NAS for video editing with 4K and 8K video clips, and my system is chugging before my network is. It's been so nice. So again, if you can step up to some business grade gear, it's a lot better. If you remember back in the day, oh, Drobos. You remember Drobos? And it's a USB 2 connection. You can get like four hard drives that plug into your PC over USB. Going network attached on small business grade gear, it has changed my life. It has been so nice. So try to step up if you can. It is pricier to make that leap, but now that my network has all been kind of, now every link in our chain is at that same sort of data connection across the entire chain. It's so great. So good. Lampros, as a cheaper alternative without RAID and stuff, how does a USB hub on the router sound with independent drives? That just depends on your router. The thing that has always bothered me about USB attached storage directly on the router is how you connect to it and how you manage it. And sometimes you get great tools on a router to interact with it in a more like folder network share kind of way. And sometimes it's like, here's FTP and that's all you get. So for example, on the QNAP, I have better tools to run a Plex server, interact with content directly, just like any other folder on Windows, or set it up as more of a web hosting style solution with something like FTP. And that to me becomes the advantage. If you're fine with just a more limited control, just plugging a hard drive into your router can be really cool. It can be your first step in a network attached store. But what I like are some of those auto triggers. I found that it is more difficult to do something like my wife's phone. She goes out to a play date with Lex and she takes a bunch of photos. As soon as her phone is on our home Wi-Fi and is plugged in to charge, it automatically uploads all of her photos to a new folder on our NAS. My wife is not someone who's going to interact with FTP. She isn't someone who plays around with different storage management and cloud apps. This is an auto trigger through QNAP that has worked consistently since we've gotten it. So for years, I've just got folders listed by date. It is not pretty, but all of her content has been copied from her phone up to our NAS. Perfect. Exactly what I want to have happen. So it's that kind of stuff where spending more to go to the proper network solution, and almost all network attached drives are going to have some kind of user management app that should be able to do something like that. This isn't just the pitch for QNAP. A Synology, also killer hardware. And then for people who are doing their own, like you can make your own NAS out of an old PC or even a Raspberry Pi or something like that. There have been people who have made really good little applets to kind of help manage that kind of data flow. That's what I'm trying to encourage more people to check out. Because also just, I'm definitely spending more than I am on my cloud storage, but my plan over the next year is to upgrade to 40 terabytes of user accessible storage. And I don't know of a way to do a cloud storage solution for that quantity of information. And then I can take the drives here and I can move them over to my mom's house. And I could do something like once a month, I can have an offsite backup that moves content just to her place. And I can back up I'm not going to back up all of my project videos, but I'd back up all of our important documents and all of our family photos. And then she could do the same for me. I mean, same with me. She could give me a little NAS, and she could back up her old laptop and her store photos and stuff. And we can just, like, offsite back each other up. And then we would have one additional resource to try and protect our data. Yeah, Awesome Possum. Again, this is a great project, but I really loved how easy the QNAP was to do the same thing. You do an old full tower as NAS server is the easy way. There are guides that make it really easy. It is very easy. I was in a pinch. I went QNAP. It was real good, so I stuck with QNAP. But, man, the Western Digital enclosures were scary AF. It was so bad. Yeah, McCorcoran, I think a lot of people are kind of finding out that the cloud isn't what was promised to them. McCorcoran says, I'm trying to minimize my reliance on cloud storage. Like, I have enough unused physical storage on my phones and tablets that sometimes I feel like an idiot for paying for Microsoft or Google cloud storage. I actually need to make a decision about renewing Microsoft 365 pretty soon. So we pay for a family Microsoft 365 account. It's like $100 a year, but that's because we're also using all five accounts. So for $100 a year, we get five 1 terabyte OneDrive accounts plus five licenses for Microsoft Office. And I genuinely prefer working in Office over working in Google Docs, and Marie needs it for her job. And so it's the necessary situation of managing that. But for around $100 a year, that's really only like $20 per account. So again, I don't know of many other cloud storage solutions where it's like 5 terabytes of online cloud storage for that price. But if you're not using all those accounts, or even if you're on a personal account, just a single account, I don't know that the maths for paying Microsoft that much to do all that. Yeah, see, exactly. McCorcoran saying, a lot of my clients that I freelance for use Microsoft Word. It is not worth... I mean, again, if this is a business expense and you're claiming it on your taxes like we do, like, you can jump through hoops and you can get some kind of compatibility and look at documents and stuff. It is such a pain trying to, like, move a spreadsheet between two different platforms. It sucks so bad. You ultimately want to say, I wish we could fix that, but genuinely... I just like OneDrive better than Google Drive. I hate that when I upload a file to someone else's folder on Google Drive, it still counts against my storage. I hate when I share a link on Google Drive, someone needs to be approved to see the link. I get stuff so often. Here's a G Drive. You can check out the account or you can check out the campaign. And then I click on it. And it's like, you don't have permission to view this. And I'm like, can you approve this account so that I can look at the thing that you sent me? Because on OneDrive, if I send you a folder and you upload content to that folder, it doesn't count against your OneDrive. It only counts against mine because I set up the folder. If I send you content, here's a link to see this thing. You can just look at it because I sent you the link. You don't have to be approved on this Google account or this OneDrive account or this Microsoft account. No, I sent you a link, and it doesn't matter what browser, what device, what account you're logged into. You just see the thing. And it kills me that Google Drive has kind of taken the de facto standard as like, that's the cloud storage we're going to use. And people look at me like I'm weird when I send them a OneDrive link, and you're like, yeah, but it worked better. It just worked better. Gormlord, do you ever remotely use your NAS? All the time. Very, very often. Very frequently. Because it's also my backup, like when I'm on the road, if I missed a file or I want to get, oh, you know what I need? I need a clip from this older video that I made. I can go and get it. It's a part of the archive. It's on that NAS. I don't have to even boot up a computer locally to get into it. I don't need to leave my workstation running for an entire trip just so that I can log into the workstation to get content. It's all on the NAS. So it is phenomenally easier to manage all that stuff. The thing that sucks is we have a really crappy upload speed. So I know if it's like a really big 4K video file that I need to pull, it's going to take a while. But I can do it, and I can do it more easily and more efficiently than running like a, you know, remote desktop kind of setup. So it works really well. A few times I've also used it to back up stuff that I was worried about, but usually I don't upload to it very often out in the field. My mom watched Lex for a couple days on our road trip. They called it Camp Nani. And we got a whole bunch of photos from her about, like, we went to this museum and we went to, a tea and, like, we did all this fun stuff. So I took all those photos and I immediately created a folder on our NAS, just called it Camp Nani, and put the date on it. And I uploaded it to the NAS then, just because they were photos on my mom's phone and I didn't want them just on my phone. These were really fun little memories. So I did upload, like, something like that. But I don't upload out in the field as often. As I use it as just like a constant store. Anything digital that's a part of our family, as long as I have electricity to my modem, my router, and the NAS in this office, I can access it anywhere I go. And it typically works about as well as backing up stuff to the cloud. If I don't have a great download speed and I try and get something off of OneDrive, It's actually kind of faster, and especially for the way that the NAS indexes your files, it's often faster to find what I'm looking for on the NAS than it is on OneDrive. And then it's a crapshoot. It depends on the data connection that I have, whether or not I can download it faster from OneDrive or from my NAS. So one last topic that we can spend a little time on, because this was the fun thing. I wanted to have at least one fun thing on this podcast this week. And we are. I was really close to potentially sticking the landing on bringing this in at 2 hours. That didn't happen. We knew it wasn't going to happen. So this is coming by way of Windows Report. Their exclusive scoop. We have a new competitor in the world of portable, handheld, PC, gaming, consoles. I totally called it. One of the companies that I thought would really embrace this space is Lenovo. So this is the Lenovo Legion Go, and it is a sort of a mashup on a Nintendo Switch and a Valve Steam Deck. It is a big screen PC gaming device with detachable controllers, and it looks like one controller has a traditional D-pad and menu buttons, but the other controller has this little square here that I think is, that's going to be a touchpad, which is one of the control surfaces that I feel is often lacking. Like the Asus ROG Ally, if you want power, if you want the better performance device, Asus. But that still doesn't completely answer the question of whether or not it kills the Steam Deck. I'm still playing a lot of games, mostly on my Steam Deck, and one of the things that I love are those dual touchpads under the thumbsticks on the Steam Deck. It is really nice when you pull up some of these like click and text adventure type games, because I am old, but having those like customizable mouse cursors, and especially for games that really aren't built to be compatible with the Steam Deck, I've been finding some really novel solutions for remapping controls and then using mouse cursors and other control elements through those touchpads. So I am very happy to see Lenovo looking at part of this design and also saying, like, hey, you know what? Having an alternate control method, a trackpad, that's a big deal. So now we also have, this is one of the biggest players in the PC laptop space. This is exactly what I pointed to. I made a video shortly after the Steam Deck came out talking about all these other boutique players, and none of them are Steam Deck killers. I don't care if it's more powerful than a Steam Deck. I also don't care if you can make a handheld that's more powerful than a Steam Deck, and it's a little bit cheaper than a Steam Deck. That's not what kills the Steam Deck. The Steam Deck is one of the easiest ways that I've found to get into a PC gaming store, buy a game, and play said game on your portable console. It is the most streamlined version of that. It is the most customizable version of the controls that you would need for PC gaming to do that well on your portable console. And it's also one of the most repairable and upgradable devices that I've seen ever. Like, your ability to get in and swap storage or replace components, or there's a company that's going to be selling an OLED, a 1080p OLED that can go into your Steam Deck. Like, that kind of user serviceability is a huge plus. And I don't feel the boutique-y companies that come out with a new console and then it kind of just vanishes until they come out with another new console. There isn't that longer-term idea of ownership and support. That longer-term idea of ownership and support will come from companies like Asus and now Lenovo. They are going to be making a product that has a certain expectation of a shelf life with a certain expectation of support past that shelf life. And they're building that, and they will be expensive products, but they're building that idea into the construction and manufacture of their units. So now we've got proper competition in this space. We've got the boutique players. We've got an entire sea of like Android style consoles and retro and emulator machines and all this other stuff. You can use your phone, just clip a controller to it. But now we've got three top tier PC gaming options from Asus, from Lenovo, and from Valve, from Steam. So this is a really pretty looking box, Lenovo Legion. I've reviewed Lenovo Legion laptops in the past. I've always been really pleased with the performance, the price to performance on their gear. But Windows Report here, it just has sort of the exclusive scoop on the images of what this thing is going to look like. It's very Steam Deck-y in its look and its sort of design aesthetic. It's a little squared off. It's a little sharper angled, but it's still a very similar idea. I don't love the sort of asymmetrical thumbsticks on a device that's going to be probably a little heavier or a little chunkier, but we've got all of the buttons and triggers. We've got like the bottom panels on the grips themselves. It looks like there's going to be a fold-out kickstand, which is another just brilliant evolution of this concept where if you want to put your Steam Deck down, which you do because it's a heavy bugger, it is not as light and as portable as a Nintendo Switch, but putting it down means you have to invest in some other carrying stand solution. And my case has a little prop-up stand for my Steam Deck that I can't use because it kind of blocks the air vents on the Steam Deck. It's not great. So Lenovo's solution to that looks a lot better, where this little stand pops out, and now you can set your Lenovo Legion down. You can just hook up. You can pop off the controllers and game that way, or you can just connect another like Bluetooth controller to play your games. So we're assuming this is probably going to be one of those newer AMD APUs. It's a Lenovo, so I'm very much expecting it to be running Windows 11. Windows 11 has been getting a lot better for touch interface, but you'd still probably want to have something like a trackpad to better control things like mouse interactions and mouse clicks and stuff like that. I'll be very curious to see over this next generation of AMD hardware if the performance delta kind of keeps maintaining this growth. I gotta say, even though it presents issues and challenges for game compatibility, knowing that the Steam Deck is less powerful, but it also has less software overhead because of the operating system used, balances out the actual practical in-the-field experience more than I would have expected. So from kind of poking around, I have not spent any significant time with the Asus ROG Ally, but looking at some of the reviews and, you know, picking it up and playing some games on it, at the expense of significant battery runtime, you can boost that Ally, and it can play more demanding games than the Steam Deck. But when you're really kind of comparing it within a mobile gaming power envelope, the Steam Deck is a lot closer than I was expecting it would be to what the Ally is capable of. So we're really going to want to see what kind of batteries this thing is packing, what kind of power management this thing is packing. One of the other updates and improvements, I would love to see dual USB ports. I think we're crazy overdue a power port and an accessory port on our Steam Deck type devices. It is silly to have a Windows 11 laptop grade portable computing machine and only have one port to plug into. And this immediately comes up because one of the things that's also been a challenge on the Steam Deck, finding ways to connect and power and recharge all of the devices when you use those glasses. You put the glasses on your face, you can plug the glasses directly into your Steam Deck, but then you can't charge your Steam Deck. So then if you want to use the glasses, use the glasses and power the Steam Deck, you've got to get a laptop hub, or you've got to prop it up and use other cabling and power. You've got to change the setting on the glasses. It's not very easy. It's not very convenient. But you know what would solve that is if I had two USB ports on the Steam Deck, I wouldn't have to worry about any of that at all. Very few of these like splitters and other devices. Like I've got a little, this is an adapter. It's a USB splitter for a phone that can power the glasses and charge the phone at the same time. But this is not rated for the power draw because you want like a 65 watt brick on your Steam Deck. So this isn't going to work for managing that quantity of electricity in any given time. And I'm sorry, the reason why that is an interesting idea to talk about. They don't have it in this article. This is hilarious because Lenovo is also potentially going to be coming out with their own glasses. I thought this was in this article. We've obtained new in-depth images with the Legion Go and info. Oh, it's just information about the Lenovo Legion AR glasses. Let me see if someone else... Lenovo Legion AR glasses. We're just going to do a quick search for this because I did see a photo of them at one point. But I just want to see if we can pull them up. Ah, here we go. That's a terrible image. Let's do that. That's a little bit better. So a similar idea to using the Rokid Max and the X-Real Air. You've got little mini OLEDs that project down with these little scooped birdbath optics. It looks like they've got a really interesting apparatus for doing a lens insert. If you have prescription lenses, that is going to clip to the inside of the glasses. And I think they've done a really good job of managing the design in a more X-Real kind of way. So the design of these look like oversized sunglasses. They don't look quite like the bug-eyed goggles of the Rokid Max. So you need extra vertical height. I can actually just show this. Let me pull these glasses back out. You need extra vertical height on a wearable display. So if I put these on my face, I take off the visor, they look a little bug-eyed. Right? They kind of sit a little higher than sunglasses would. Like you can kind of see under like my lower eyelids. And they have these like really distinctively scooped elements for each individual lens. And that's because there are mini OLEDs flat. So they're pointing down. The image is being projected down. And then there are these scooped, it's kind of like a periscope, these scooped optics that then point the image into my eyeballs. But you need to be able to mount the OLEDs on top. So you kind of need this extra height, even though they don't quite come down. And it's funny because then you put on the blackout shield, and I can't see myself on camera right now, but I think this looks now more reasonable, like a pair of sunglasses you would normally wear, just because they kind of balanced out a little bit better the height of the optics against the lower plastic bezel on the bottom of the glasses. So when we look at Lenovo's design, I think they've done a really good job in this rendering of balancing out. So these will probably still sit higher up on the face than they need to for just being a pair of sunglasses. And I bet you when you look through on this top section, in real life, you'll be able to see that that isn't an open lens that lets light through. It's probably just a window border for the actual optics behind that sunglasses lens. But it's, that looks like a good design to me. And it looks like it's going to have, you know, built-in speakers. I'll be really curious to see how they handle the cable management, because if it's not just a standard USB-C, that's where I think TCL got into some small issues with their glasses. The cable was either hard connected to the original Nextwear, or it had a proprietary magnetic connector on the Nextwear G, I think was their follow-up. So it looks like Lenovo might be using some kind of hard connection, which I think is a bad play. You want the ability to detach the cable, replace the cable. It's the part that's most likely to wear out under normal operation without damage, is a cable that runs through part of an eyepiece, I mean, earpiece, and then has flex and wear and tear. That boot will eventually degrade. But putting all of these together, that is a mainstream manufacturer joining the portable console space. Another Steam Deck competitor, we should always be excited about that. But what's even more interesting is that they're going to take the face display seriously in giving you a large screen projection. And Lenovo doesn't put a ton of money into marketing, but they'll certainly be able to show off this idea better than Rokid, TCL, or Xreal have been able to market this idea. So this is looking like it's going to be one of the first legitimate steps, if it all comes out together and it's part of a bundle, in normalizing the idea of a face display on a portable gaming machine. So beyond, like, do we have VR or mixed reality or huge ski goggles that weigh on your head, you want to play your games. Plug this in, put on some sunglasses, kick back, be comfortable, play your game. And everything that I've said for the last almost 3 years now is going to be validated. But now, oh, but now it's good. You know, Lenovo did it, so now you know that it's real serious. And you're like, yeah, you could have been doing this for a while now. The Xreals have been awesome. The Rokid Max, fantastic. The Rokid Air, kind of okay. The TCLs, great. There's a new company, Vertu, I think is how you pronounce it. They look awesome. I have not played with them yet. We have had these solutions and these little boutique-y options, and you could have been playing with them. But again, it always seems to take at least one company, like a Lenovo or an Asus or a Dell, something like that. I'm just really glad, because Lenovo put a ton of money into R&D for real consumer-facing augmented reality. They had a ridiculous pair of glasses with 6 degrees of tracking. You plug it into your ThinkPad, and it was it was really complicated, really big. It looked like it was going to be really expensive. Seeing Lenovo make a simpler face display is encouraging, because I feel we need to solve a lot of problems with covering the basics first. Getting screens on someone's face has been an incredible challenge, and consumers are not jumping on this stuff. And if we can't get them to solve some of the basics, we'll never get there if we're only selling like $3,500 Apple Vision Pros. $100,000 dev kits of a $3,500 Vision Pro is not going to move the needle on consumer adoption of mixed reality. But selling 400,000 or 500,000 headsets that are just basic face displays would teach us a lot about optics, about ergonomics, about fit, about accessibility, and get people creating some kind of content for a viewer projection screen. So I am incredibly excited to see Lenovo's handheld. I might try to go hands-on with a Legion if I can get my hands on one. I'm probably not going to be looking to buy one, because I'm perfectly happy with my Steam Deck, especially for the style of gaming that I like to engage with. Totally good. I'm very well sated. Especially for all the indie games that I like to play, the twin stick shooters, some of the little like tower defense kinds of games. Like, it's all been good. It's all been great. And especially you can go and grab a Steam Deck refurb now if you want to get a reconditioned machine directly from Valve. But without competition, these products won't get better. And what I have, my expectation for a Steam Deck 2 is not necessarily that I need it to be more powerful, but I want it to have a better screen and I want it to get better battery life. So for me to use it and play the games that I like to play, I do want to see an updated APU, but an updated APU that I could also use at a lower wattage. Like I can undervolt it or something like that. And then I definitely want it to have a better battery. So it's pretty crazy. I really like this trend. And I'm telling folks, especially for anyone who would still be watching my podcast into 2 hours and 20 minutes of me rambling, if you have the means, if you have the accessibility, if you can try it, get a face display on your face and you will experience something that you've never experienced before. And you might hate it. You might not like it at all. But I believe there is huge opportunity and there is huge potential to displace the current solutions we have for packing an external monitor. We started this podcast out with me laughing at a $1,000 LG suitcase television. Do you want to carry a 27-inch 1080p screen in a suitcase, or do you want to project a movie theater-sized image out in space in front of you, and you can sit as comfortably as you want anywhere you travel and see a huge screen image at a similar resolution, but probably at a better contrast than what you can achieve with a suitcase television? Once you get over the unfamiliarity of putting displays on your face, I think more people would like this experience over an extra piece of luggage that they would need to carry.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY10 with no spaces. You'll save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's dual driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's Pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout to save some scratch. Now, let's get on with the show.
Colonel Corn Pop, cyborg eyeballs when. So I used to be the guy. I mean, you can probably find quotes of me saying stuff like this, but I used to be the guy who was like, I'm ready to be a cyborg, put implants in my brain, sign me up. Unfortunately, now I've kind of backed off of that because too many people are in that space like Elon Musk. And boy, howdy, am I not letting Elon Musk tinker with my brain ever. No, that sounds like a bad idea. So I'm going to leave that one alone. Aditi Anil, SGG plus Lenovo collaboration when? My relationship with Lenovo kind of died while I was at Pocket Now. And I've reached out to them on a couple of things, both on the Motorola side and on the Lenovo side. And they don't seem interested in working with me. So my ability to go hands-on with a Legion is probably going to be limited. And also, like, I really need to get back. I want to do just another follow-up video on the Razer Edge, because that thing is so much better than all of the videos that kind of came out and slammed it for being Android gaming. There is a conversation you need to have about limited software for it. But with all of the new stories coming out about, like, Nintendo Switch emulation and PC emulation. We got people working on just proper PC emulation for Android devices. And the Razer Edge is kind of the conversation you want to have. If you're the type of person who's inclined to tinker with that kind of software, because it's a dedicated machine for that with a gorgeous display, its own controller solution, and active cooling. Because you'll want active cooling when you start emulating PC gaming, AAA PC games, on your Android device. The active cooling is kind of a big deal. And you can get active cooling at a reasonable price that is sort of competitive performance per watt and performance per dollar against something like a Red Magic smartphone. From McCorkerin 3, Ben's Gadget Reviews got into some hot water when he said in his preview of the Vision Pro, $3,500 is not a lot to Americans. People had to remind him that the average American is unable to handle a $500 emergency and does not get healthcare. So let me say, when I show off these glasses, this is a high-dollar luxury purchase. This is $500. It's like $480 if you buy them on Amazon right now. I think the Amazon listing just went live. This is not cheap. Because what is cheap would be buying a small 720p portable monitor. Like a 13-inch mini portable display. I think you can find those for under $200 now. Regularly. And they're not going to be amazing, but they'll be practical, portable, and compatible with almost anything that can handle a video source. $500 is now stepping into exotic territory to solve the problem of displaying an image on the go. And if you really want to drive these, you need to look at the cost of the glasses and where you will drive the content. So these aren't just $500, they're $500 plus the price of a phone that can utilize them. So unless you have an LG Velvet, you're not going to drive these on mid-ranger or entry-level phones because none of those phones support video output. If you have a premium phone, you still might not be able to drive these glasses if you have, I have my Pixel 7 Pro. This does not have video output for being an expensive phone. I've got my Pixel Fold. That's a $2,000 folding phone. No video output. Over here in front of me, I have a Xiaomi 13. So full retail, this was like, what, a $700 phone at launch? And you can get it for a lot cheaper now. This has USB 2. This does not have video output on that USB. So this is a luxury exotic purchase for putting a display on your face at $500, and you need to factor in at least $120 to get a brain to power these glasses. So now my $500 purchase is really more like a $650 purchase after tax. $650 is a lot of money. And that can be a console in a game. That can be a laptop for a student, a nice student-grade laptop, not, you know, the plasticky garbage that your kid might get assigned to you. This is the entertainment purchase a family would have to decide on. It could be a really nice iPad, and a really nice iPad can do a variety of things very well. It almost doesn't quite get you into current Galaxy Tab S territory. What is the starting rate? Is it $700? It's $699? Someone please correct me. Is the starter Galaxy Tab S9, is that somewhere around $600 or $700? Anyway. To look at this and say this is the cheap option, and then to say something like, oh, but Americans, they'll spend $3,500 on a beta dev kit, first generation mixed reality headset that currently brings nothing new to the mixed reality landscape because it's a dev kit that Apple hopes developers will solve those problems for them, and to kind of shrug it off and just say, you know, Americans, rich people, to me, would read as a little tone deaf. And I feel like a lot of people get left behind in our tech conversations because we reviewers spend a lot of time with products that are ridiculously expensive. I've got a Pixel Fold, hashtag gift from Google. I didn't buy the Pixel Fold. I'm very grateful to my relationship with the folks at Team Pixel for me to be able to tell you how freaked out I am about plastic-screened folding tablets. I used some of our Some Gadget Guy budget, courtesy of the folks on Patreon, to continue producing content on my Xiaomi 13 Ultra, which was a significantly more expensive phone than I think most people should be out there trying to buy. I want people to play with these face displays and I want more adoption, but who I'm talking to are not the people out there who are like, we have a family budget to buy a PlayStation or an iPad, and that's our family entertainment budget. That's it. That is the purchase. Are we going to get more mileage out of this game console, or are we going to have more multifaceted computing experiences with an iPad? I'm not trying to get in that conversation and say, hey, instead of your PlayStation or your iPad, you should spend $500 on some glasses. Ha ha. No, I'm trying to reach someone who's already inclined to try something like Samsung Dex or Moto Ready 4. I'm trying to talk to someone who already has the means to own something like a Steam Deck. And that is a small piece of a small demographic of tech literate people. And that's the kind of conversation I'm trying to host. This notion that Apple can solve this problem with mixed reality by putting out $3,500 ski goggles is mind-boggling to me. I do not understand why we are entertaining this conversation in the tech space right now, while every trend in technology is pointing to consumers holding onto devices longer, trying to shop more aggressive sales, buying aggressively on refurbished units and used hardware, and are trying to maximize every penny of that interaction. I do not understand how Vision Pro has any seat at this conversation right now, has any seat at the table for this conversation, and is being taken seriously when it brings nothing but higher resolution optics and a funky face screen to the table. I don't get it. I really don't. And I think it's a bad look when techies don't acknowledge that we get tons of traffic on the exotic stuff, right? If I show you a bunch of videos on $1,000 plus phones, $2,000 foldables, I get tons of traffic. That's exciting stuff to talk about. It's kind of like if you're a car reviewer, you're going to get way more traffic on a Corvette video than you will on a Corolla video. There's something fundamentally broken about our popularity aspects, and the real daily driver products always take the back seat because, well, I mean, people really own those things. So we don't need to talk about them as much. If we really looked at the landscape, we should be making 10 videos on the Galaxy A series for every one video we put out on Galaxy S or Galaxy Z. That would actually be joining the conversation with the devices people really own, the average consumers out there, and we would be contributing to the benefit of their purchase. We would be making their Galaxy A a more talked about device, a more understood device. They'd be getting more out of their purchase. If you've got a Galaxy A and you're watching all of my videos about Galaxy S, you're not learning anything about your Galaxy A. That doesn't happen. But now I feel like tech reviewers are starting to believe that demographic difference. Like, because they get all the traffic on their expensive exotic products, they're starting to believe that that really is like the average when there is zero data to support that. Like, everything that we've seen, the vast majority of smartphone purchases happen under $500. Like, and again, by a ratio of like 10 or 12 to 1. And I've got people Someone got really upset with my Rokid Station tip video that you could use the Rokid Station as a Steam link to your PC or your Steam Deck. And he got real mad. Like, you did not spoon feed the audience to say that you could do the same thing with a phone and the glasses, that you don't need to buy the Steam link to do that. And I had to point out to him, that is 1/12 of the smartphone buying population who might have that capability. Oh, but you still need to tell people blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no, I made a video about a tip or a trick for someone who owns the Rokid Station. In my full video about the Rokid Station, I explained some of the pros and cons and why you might want to buy this or why you might not want to buy this. But it is not my job in a tip video about the Rokid Station to say, if you're lucky enough to own a 10% phone that can do this stuff, you don't need to own the Rokid Station. So thank you for coming to my video about the Rokid Station where I tell you that 10% of the smartphone buying audience doesn't need to own the Rokid Station. That's not what this 3-minute video is supposed to accomplish. And then he just started slinging epithets in my general direction. So again, that was a lost cause. I waste a lot of time in the comments on my own videos. So yeah, I take that kind of stuff real personal. Because I feel like we have a completely warped landscape on the conversation about consumer tech. And I think that leads people to believe that, like, science fiction is right around the corner. All the people that really do seem to think that, like, Vision Pro is going to bring us actual consumer AR. Nah, I don't see it. I really don't. It's going to be another mixed reality headset. And I don't think developers are going to have the tools to do anything, you know, so groundbreaking or so boundary pushing with it that we completely forget about every other VR and mixed reality solution out there. It makes me frustrated because people could be experiencing this stuff and having these kinds of profound experiences that I'm trying to describe. They could be doing it for a lot less. It'd be a lot less expensive to do that. Barry Johnson, come on, Juan. Of course the suitcase. Matter of fact, I think all TVs and monitors should come in a briefcase. Just imagine all the extra engineering and hardware, and you're like, oh, I could take my actual, you know, 70-inch TV on with me on the road. All I need to do is put a folding hinge. There we go. So you take your 70-inch TV and you fold it in half. I mean, don't mind the crease, right? We're totally fine with creases on all of our content. And then you put it in a giant briefcase and it's really like only having a 35-inch screen. So then you have a giant piece of hardware and you take it out and you unfold it and you have your 70-inch TV anywhere that you want your 70-inch TV. See, there you go. We're just not thinking big enough. 27-inch TV, come on. Who can even watch, you know, Bluey on a 27-inch TV? That's ridiculous. Gormlord, I have seen the Pimax portable. That looks super cute. And again, when we're talking about classic arcade and 8-bit and 16-bit emulation, and man, there's so much good gaming. There's so many generations of great gaming out there. Like, anyone who's like, oh, it doesn't play enough games, it doesn't have enough software, then you're not looking hard enough. There's great stuff to do. And I have to throw one more shout out to JMan150. Random Hobby gifted a tier one sub to Random Hobby. JMan, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, especially as we're starting to kind of wrap this show up, start closing this stuff down. I just want to get through a few more of these comments here. From McCorcoran3, that's a good point. People should recommend phones that you could buy to use this with, even if it's a used S10e or an LG Velvet. You can get those for around $100. Man, let me tell you, plugging stuff like this into an S10e, oh, Snapdragon 855, that's not going to be gooder enough. That is still significant overkill for the vast majority of daily computer needs. The A55 is a real good chip. It's real good. The 765 in the LG Velvet is a solid chip. You can get a lot of work done on that. It could be someone's just computer away from home. That's great. But again, Snapdragon HN2 so that you can open up TikTok. Techies are so dumb. All right. McCorkran is saying MSRP is $799 for the Tab S. Is okay, so I've got from J-Man and from McCorkran. If we're looking at a Tab S9, we're looking between $700 and $800. J-Man150 is saying $799 British pounds for a base model Tab S9. $800 is a lot for what people use tablets for. So, yeah. Let's see. Sorry, I'm catching up. Just finance your Vision Pro. There you go. You get that Apple credit card. They're trying to game the system with, like, giving you the illusion of a savings account that gives you better returns. Pacostin, here is a question. Come on. There we go. I don't need to pin this comment. I pinned it, so it's just going to live there forever now. Here is a question. A pair of those AR glasses or a 3D printer, what scratched your creative itch more? The 3D printer is scratching my creative itch more because, like, just looking up design templates and I'm trying to get into the actual, like, 3D design software. I'm real bad at all of this stuff. Is encouraging a lot of new stuff that I wasn't previously familiar with. The glasses are so much handier for me for more the content consumption and gaming solutions, but on the road trip, it was really nice popping out my Robo Ancala, plugging in my X-Reel Beam, and then throwing on my X-Reel Air and having a huge monitor to back up my tablet. So that was awesome. So it was definitely good for that kind of content creation on the road kind of an experience. But 3D printing in general, I was so far behind on learning about 3D printing that getting an inexpensive 3D printer has, man, it's just fun. It's something totally fresh that I was not familiar with before. So let me see. Why is this being weird? I'm just trying to get out of that comment. Station! I love that joke, Dave Burns. There we go. Sorry, KMK0. I heard a tech channel the other day suggest an iPad over an Android because they are more capable. Sure. I mean, you'd have to demonstrate that. And it always seems that iPad and iOS users kind of struggle with that. But okay. Sure. It's more capable. I'll give you on an iPad Pro, it does make me cranky that I can't use DaVinci Resolve on an Android tablet. But beyond a very singular use like that, it's a bit harder. A bit harder to make that blanket claim about capability because, I don't know, as much as I hate Samsung, I really like DeX. DeX is pretty great. It's not as limited as, like, Stage Manager is. I mean, I guess it's more capable Stage Manager than DeX, but that's neither here nor there. Let's see. And a couple other people saying, like, 800 or so. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, a Galaxy Tab S9 is not cheap. That one's... There's that kind of gulf. It's why I really liked, you know, the OnePlus Pad and the Pixel tablet, but they're not quite as laptop-grade replacement solutions as, like, a Tab S9. Tab S9 gets you to a point where I would very comfortably be able to leave a laptop at home and really not have much of a change to my workflow, just in the same way that Moto Ready4 and a good display or a laptop dock or something like that, totally capable. But you're paying a lot for those types of products. You are already talking about a premium on top of a premium to support that. So, Diago, Android Police is now all in on iPads. Well, you got to go where the traffic goes. Can't have a site like Android Police and only talk about Android stuff, because then you don't get, you know, 50% of the North American potential viewership on your content. So you got to, you know, stroke all the egos. You got to make sure that there's always the hierarchy of Apple wins if it's Apple versus Android, but then Samsung wins if it's Android versus Android. And then you will make 80% of the North American consumer market happy. Because statistically speaking, that's probably what they own. I mean, this is just basic web stuff, right? You want to make money. That's how you make money. Oh, Ghost Starscream. I've heard channels saying that the Tab S series does a lot more than iPads, but still recommend iPads. You know, I mean, I'm over here with, Muppinish. I'm over here with my Robo and Kala. I'm good. I actually think Windows on ARM is going to come in a way that really disrupts a lot of actual work, but it just won't have the mind share or the advertising behind it. I just learned there is a new flavor of GIMP. GIMP is working on a proper, it's super, super beta right now, and I haven't even had a chance to try it out. Seriously, I've just installed it. But they are now working on a Windows on ARM flavor of GIMP. Like, this is silly. This is silly that there's this huge tech blind spot for an inexpensive Windows tablet that can work as a laptop replacement that has really good support for current Windows software, has decent support for Windows legacy software, can install Ubuntu, run it inside Windows, so you have full access to all of your Linux applications, and can run Android 13 inside Windows, and all of your Android apps show up like Windows programs. And over the summer, that Robo and Kala was on sale for $599 with a magnetic keyboard. I feel like that's probably a better buy for most people out there than any iPad. So there you go. It's great. Why don't we go ahead and wrap this up before I do actually get to 3 hours and my voice completely fails. 10 minutes shy of 3 hours. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This is a really, I was very anxious about putting this show together, and we still have some wind and little splatterings of rain out there, but I hope everybody was able to kind of hunker down, stay safe. Crazy weather across the world, really, but Californians definitely had a very anxious weekend. So anyone who was West Coast, I hope you and your family and friends are all safe and accounted for and doing okay. We're going to be back next week. It's the last Monday of August, and that will be my pajama podcast. And I'm wondering, I'm going to maybe put something out on the Patreon or maybe on Mastodon, if we would maybe want to try and do like a game stream instead of me just rambling on about reviews and stuff. Just our final like back to school summer wrap up. And maybe I just throw up JStress, and anyone who wants to join, we could have a conversation about tech while I try to kick all of your butts at Tetris. I don't know. Is anyone here good at Tetris? Because I'm getting S scores on Tetris Effect, so I'm a pretty big deal. I'm kind of hot stuff at Tetris, and if anyone wants to try and show me up, then let's see if we can make that happen, yo. JMan150, we are not past the three-hour mark. I am at 2 hours, 51 minutes, and 22 seconds. Dave Burns succeeds at kicking our ass in Tetris. Well, how about this? I'm going to loosely plan for a game stream next week. Still conversation. We're still going to hang out. We're going to chat pajama podcast style. But you have a week to shore up your Tetris abilities. And if we make that happen, then we can do that. So we'll see how we do. So, folks, I want you all to have a fantastic week. I want you to do awesome using your technology. I want you to be awesome using your technology. And I want you to take care of yourselves so that you can continue to take care of others. And you never get the thanks that you deserve, but I appreciate you all. Especially for everybody who's been supporting the content on this channel and catching all the other streams from amazing podcasters over the week. It is appreciated. We really do appreciate all the help, the support, the sharing, and the suggestions in the conversation, because that's what we really do it for. I'll catch you all back next week. I love you all. Be safe. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.